Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
What is your thought on that suggestion, this belief, this notion that somehow all of these terroristic acts that are committed against black people, that somehow this is the result of white people being ignorant about some aspect of racism or lacking awareness, knowledge of racism?
Yeah, you know, I take, as you know, I have a huge problem with this issue, with this concept, right? I find it untenable and I find it apologetic to endow white people with virtue and almost a childlike innocence when they have to deal with something like white supremacy and racism. The argument seems to proceed on the fact that even when white people do seemingly deliberate acts against racialized peoples, racialized folk, that even those acts where they directly benefit from it are done out of ignorance. And I think that what this sustains is this kind of cherub nature, this nature that white people are really aiming and willing to learn and to correct their behavior if just this right black person came along and taught them what to do. I find that just ridiculous, right? I mean, we have to look at the historical context. We know that white people have done the same types of behaviors. They've discriminated against black people. They've called black people niggers. They've called black people God knows what other names. They've always vitiated blackness. They've secluded and segregated blackness. To repeat those things doesn't seem to be the work of ignorance. In fact, it seems to be the repetition of historical knowledge about how to treat black folk. So when we see the same thing, ignorance seems to be just an unrealistic apologetic. The other problem I have with this is, as you say, this makes it way, it makes its way into the academy. I mean, the dominant way that we do race and racism today in the university is to endow white people with this type of ignorance. And actually the work that I'm doing right now on anti-ethics specifically responds to this issue, right? That every time we think that we're talking about race or racism, what we do is we elevate white people's morality and their type of character so that they become these very neutral and observer speakers where they can be influenced and allegedly objectively arbitrate racial realities before them. This is all false. I mean, even the work that's done in implicit bias shows that white people have some very deep-seated cultural and unconscious anti-black biases in their interactions and in terms of their social reality when looking at engaging black folk. So to suggest that white people are simply innocent, right, because ignorance does in many ways connote innocence, to suggest that they're innocent simply because they do not know or hence ignorant doesn't really capture the cultural and the psychological works of how racism against black people functions.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, January 15, 2020, so I have been told. One, we will be here tomorrow, same broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Harriet A. Washington, one of Gus T.'s favorite authors, Medical Apartheid, one of my top five books all time. We are reading her most recent offering, A Terrible Thing to Waste, talking about environmental racism. We only did session number one last week, so you are not really behind at all. But we'll be hooking up tomorrow just on chapter two, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Woo, man, oh man. It snowed 3 straight days in Seattle, which never happens. Don't be mistaken. There is no blizzard. We didn't get a half a foot of snow. It's enough of a dusting. I think we probably got a few inches, maybe 2-3 inches, but just enough. And with the cold weather and icing that, you know, since it doesn't do all this very frequently, that all of the goodies at the grocery store are gone and lots of things closed down and, you know, that sort of conduct for winter weather. Gus T was prepared. I saw it last week. I talked about it that, looks like it might do some snowing or what have you. I will be prepared. I readied myself for the broadcast this evening, and I got up early this morning, made vegan sweet potato pie. We had vegan sweet potato pie at the Florida Yoga Retreat. That was amazing. That was my first time making sweet potato pie, and vegan, no less. Enjoyed it so much. I had purchased pie shells to take with me to Florida because I was concerned about whether or not they would have pie shells that didn't have all that nonsense in them. And went ahead and trusted that they would have pie shells, which they did. So I had pie shells at the ready. I just really had to get sweet potatoes, which I did. I smuggled sweet potatoes all the way to Florida, so of course I could get sweet potatoes. But I made sweet potato pie and watched the snow. Amazing sweet potato pie. Patti LaBelle, watch your back. Vegan sweet potato pie. I think folks from the retreat, I took pictures again. I think this one might even be a little bit better than the Florida retreat. We shall see. I said sweet potato pie might become a yoga retreat staple for the cows. The Toronto yoga retreat, May 21 to May 24. Whew. Late spring in Toronto. We'll do some yoga. Vegan sweet potato pie. We could do other desserts. You know, peach cobbler, it'll be spring. We could do other things, but vegan sweet potato pie, we could do that. Have Chef Nadira in to do all plant-based meals. We'll have counter-racist workshops, food workshops. Lovely time in Toronto for victims of white supremacy. Deadline to register February 29. Drop an email if you have questions, concerns. Had a couple email me today and say that they wanted to participate. If you have questions, need details, again, drop an email. We have done Virginia for the yoga retreat and Florida. Looking forward to Toronto. Whew. Speaking of yoga, our broadcast for today, it'll be difficult for listeners to appreciate like how we walked to this program. We're about to do our 11-year anniversary next month. I heard about the author for the book we're going to discuss this evening, our guest for the program. I heard about her work first in 2018. Now, for folks, we don't have to go through my whole history of yoga, but some of our guests, it is tied right in with my history of yoga. That was the first time I saw her work. She was invited to Seattle's Grinning Yogi to do a workshop on social justice. It stood out because it was a black face on the wall in a studio where there are very, very, very few black people, in a city where there are very, very, very few black people. I was not at the studio at the time of the workshop because I was in 200-hour teacher training at the time. I had just started practicing yoga and was off to do teacher training. So I left the studio, went to a different studio where I'd already registered for teacher training, did that, came back. We progress, go through racism and yoga. I move around, enroll to do my internship at a different studio. And our guest for today's program, name comes up again. Owner of the studio, woman who hired me first for the intern, then to ultimately teach at the studio. She says, hey, have you heard of this book, Skill in Action? And she had an autographed copy, no less. She said, have you heard of this book, Skill in Action? It is amazing. It talks all about racism. Don't you do that podcast on racism? It's amazing. And it's written by a black author. I believe that conversation even started with talking about lack of yoga books written by black authors. And she has a library. I talked about this before. They have a library at the studio, and they did not have a whole lot of books written by black authors. And she talked about that, that was something that was gnawing at her, that she was trying to get other books written by black authors. Boop, she had this one. We started talking about it, and I mean literally hours later. So she departs, studio owner, boop, boop, boop. Different white woman comes in, yoga instructor who also teaches there. She comes in and she says, man, we just did a yoga teacher training. I think she's in a 300-hour program. Just did a teacher training session, room brimming with white women, as it usually is. And she said, we had this session. We talked about social justice. And we had this book, Skill in Action. It's written by this black female. She's a yoga instructor, too. And I mean, wow, it was tough. And I said, wow, really? What was so tough about it? And she said, I mean, it's a room full of white women, and we're reading this book, and it's all about racism. And I mean, wow, we got to a few points. We just sat there, and it was just silence, that kind of awkward silence. Nobody really said anything, and just kind of had to sit there. It's like, So the book kept coming up. And I said, I will reach out and see if we can get her on the program to discuss racism, white supremacy, and yoga. That is what her book is all about, and using her yoga practice as an instructor to help with the production of justice. I can even give you a goofy side note. I say that at the end of every class. I told you I have to give a little bit of my yoga practice as we kind of go through with our guest this evening. I never say namaste at the end of class because of white supremacy. That is not going to change as long as I'm practicing, and or as long as there is a system of white supremacy. I don't say it when I practice. I don't say it when I teach. When I teach, I conclude class by saying, I practice in order to maintain my sanity and to help with the production of justice. I ask my students, let's all think about why we yoga. We'll take a collective breath and think about our respective answers. Inhale, and we do the exhale. That is how I end class. And for the first time, I had a student this week, just literally 2 days ago, white woman. She said, why do you say that at the end of class about producing justice? I could have just gave her this book, Skill in Action. Look at this here book. This is why I say that, and not namaste. But our guest for the program, super glad to have her on the broadcast. Always a hoot when we can have black yoga instructors. The book again, Skill in Action, Radicalizing Your Yoga Practice. What is that word? To create a just world. So glad to have her with us. Joining us live, the author, Michelle Cassandra Johnson. Ms. Johnson, you're with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be on your show.
It is our pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing a bit out of your very busy schedule. I know for some of our listeners, this is their first time hearing about you and the work that you do. You can visit her website, michellecjohnson.com. It's linked at the website. Again, michellecjohnson.com. Anything that you would like our listeners to know about who you are and the work you do, Ms. Johnson? Well, you said Michelle.
Yeah, I have been teaching yoga for about 11 years and practicing for almost 15 plus years. And I've been a dismantling racism trainer for over 2 decades. And so when I went to yoga teacher training, of course, I had an anti-racism lens in an industry that has been whitewashed. And I approached that 200-hour with this lens of, why aren't we talking about racism? Why aren't we talking about oppression? Why aren't we talking about what's going on in the community? And so that's really driven and motivated my work. And also, I have a background as a clinical social worker, although I'm not practicing now. But I practiced as a clinical social worker for about 20 years. And my work now is to lead dismantling racism workshops all over the country and skill in action workshops. And those workshops are an intersection of justice and yoga, and exactly what the title of the book says, how do we radicalize and decolonize spiritual spaces so that we can create a just world. And I'm really happy to be here.
We are happy to have you. We've been doing emails since November. Matter of fact, so many things have changed since we started our email tags to set this program up again. She is so busy. So when this started, I was an intern at the studio. So at this point, I've been hired and teaching there for months and have done another yoga retreat since we started all of this with, oh, yeah.
Wow.
The woman that I'm hoping hires me, and blah, 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 blah. The resume is way out of date from that time. And I think it's just been 3 months. Wow. for folks who have not seen you, again, MichelleCJohnson.com. You can go to the website. Lots of lovely pictures. You are a black female, yes?
Yes, I am. Yes.
Awesome. We are doing things in reverse again for listeners who have been with us at the Cows for 11 years or 11 days. The normal pattern is not happening. You already shared that you have been doing dismantling racism work for years, even before you became a yoga instructor. And so that greatly has influenced how you teach and practice. And you have definitions in your book, Skill in Action. What definition do you use for the term white supremacy?
White supremacy is an ideology and belief system that's based on whiteness being seen as superior, and Black, Indigenous, and people of color being seen as inferior. And part of the reason I use that definition of white supremacy is because sometimes people just get in the personal when we talk about racism, and they don't focus on the institutional and the cultural, which lets a lot of people off the hook. And I always say when I offer this definition of white supremacy that I'm implicated in this system as well, in a different way than white folks, because I'm a Black woman. But it's the air we breathe in, right? White supremacy is around us, and we have to contend with it. And some of us have to figure out how to navigate it, and some of us have to figure out how to dismantle it. So that's my definition of white supremacy.
Awesome. I will try to write down notes as you were sharing. White supremacy, a belief, whiteness is superior, and or individuals classified as white, and that Black people and or people of color are inferior, and getting and making sure that we get past the personal and understanding the institutional and cultural apparatus that uphold white supremacy. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And just for extra detail, when you say the institutional and cultural aspects of institutional white supremacy, what does that mean exactly?
Well, when I was a child in school, I learned about teaching tolerance. I learned about getting along.
Uh-oh. Michelle, are you still with us? Let's see. Not hearing you. Not sure if you hit your mute button. Looks like, so my audio is still coming through. Michelle, can you hear me? Hello, can you hear me? Not hearing you. Can you hear us, Michelle? I'll give it a second, and then if I don't hear anything, I dialed Michelle on my line, so if I don't hear anything in a second or two, I'll disconnect her. It looks like she's still connected. So you're still on my line, it looks like, Michelle, but I'm not hearing you. Your volume just vanished when we were getting the institutional part. Definitions are important. Let's see. So I'm not hearing you. I will hang you up and get you back on the line. Let's see. All right. So I'm still connected on the, yes, I'm still connected. Now I'll go see if we can add Miss Michelle Cassandra Johnson back with us. Okay. Thank you for your patience, Cal's listeners. Let's see if we can do it without getting the ring.
The phone just hung up on us.
It did. That was so I was going to say so crazy, but that sort of thing happens, and we were right at such an important point with the definition. Like, look at that. Man, to be expected.
I always think white supremacy is listening, and they're cutting us off. They, like, made the phone drop.
The usual suspects, but we are persevering. We will not be denied. So we got cut off.
We are.
We were at institutional and cultural.
Institutions.
Yes, ma'am. Let's hear it.
Yes. So I was talking about every institution and organization we interact with has been influenced by white supremacy. And then culture, as I was saying, is the air we breathe in. So it's norms, standards, beliefs, values, who holds value and narratives or stories, and who controls the story. And so it's different than like me getting along with white, an individual white person, right? It's that institutions were created to uphold white supremacy, right? And culture is created to perpetuate white supremacy. That's very different than me not getting along with someone or me learning to get along with someone. So it's a much broader definition.
Uphold and perpetuate, key verbs there, uphold and perpetuate, much larger than just whether or not you get along with Robert or Susan, who happened to be classified as white. Do you have the same definition for racism or a different definition?
The definition for racism is from critical race theory and from a group of trainers I worked with for almost 2 decades. And so this is a definition people will hear if they go to a race equity training. So racism is race prejudice, and everyone embodies prejudice. But it's race prejudice backed by social and institutional power. And that institutional and social power really has to do with policies and practice and how wealth has been built and who's been backed by power and has the capacity to perpetuate white supremacy and uphold power, right? Those words again. So racism is race prejudice plus social and institutional power, which is about access to resources, access to decision makers. And racism equals a system of advantage based on race. So if people are born with white skin, then they're advantaged because of the belief that whiteness is better and superior. Racism is a system of oppression based on race. So Black, Indigenous folks of color are being oppressed as white people are being uplifted and privileged because of this system. And racism is a system designed to build and maintain white supremacy, that ideology and belief system based on white being seen as superior and everyone else, folks of color, being seen as inferior. So that's the definition that I use it's in my life and in every training that I lead. That's the definition I offer.
Spectacular. Folks who, for a decade plus, I've always said it's very important getting definitions out. I share my definition of racism at the beginning of programs and often ask our guests for their definition. So many times in these conversations, people proceed as though everybody already knows the definition or that we all have the same definition for racism. And I found that neither of those is the case frequently.
Right.
The definition that I use for, and I use the same definition for white supremacy and racism. I use those terms as synonyms, on this broadcast and in general. The definition I use for both terms is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
I think it's absolutely accurate. And I appreciate the part of the definition that speaks about the global system, because racism certainly is affecting every part of the globe. And colonization has touched almost every part of the globe and the world. And the word dedicated feels really poignant because of intention and impact. Some white folks feel like they're not participating in this system. And if I, as a Black woman, can say that I'm implicated in this system in a very different way than white folks, then white folks should be able to say they're implicated and they're dedicated to upholding whiteness, because it gives white people power. And why would white folks want to give up power? So I really appreciate that language around it.
We've had many white guests on the program where that has become a point of contention, the word dedication. I will say one important, I think, difference when I talk about institutions, because I pointed out those verbs, uphold and perpetuate. It's white people. That is one of the times, or one of the things that I've seen pretty consistently, when white people and non-white people give their definitions for racism or talk about racism, they'll say institutional racism. They'll go to laws and lineage and history and things that have happened and that sort of thing. And that's one, especially if it's a white person, I say institutions are people. You don't have laws. None of those things operate without individuals who classify themselves as white, who are enforcing making laws, refining laws, whatever, making new laws, whatever it needs to happen to make sure that all of this continues maintaining white power. The institution is the individual white man, white woman that we see every day. So often I find when they say, when they use metaphors, it's in the air we breathe and things like that. No, it is John. It is Susan. It is Harold. It is Rebecca. It is the white people we see every day. That is the institution. Nothing else that people mention when they talk about institutional or systemic racism, none of that works at all without individual white people. That is one key difference that I would note in our definitions when we talk about institutions. Did you have a comment to that?
Well, I think that one reason I talk about it as the air we breathe or the water we're swimming in is because, you know, for white folks, it's easy for them to distance and not see themselves as part of the, as part of white supremacy, right? As part of the system. And if I say it's the air we breathe in, it means we're breathing in the same air. We're just having a very different experience of it. Like the impact of the air is different on me than it is on white folks. And so that's why I explain it that way, that it is everywhere. There's no way to transcend, to escape from, to avoid white supremacy. It is. It's the what is, right? We're not going to be able to escape that. And so white folks' work is understanding how they're implicated in it and what their options are. And I really do appreciate the like, well, white folks made the institutions and they made the system. I think that is a helpful frame because it means it's not about something that's outside of white people. It's like every individual white person is participating in the system in some way. So there's no way they can escape from that, right? And escape from creating conditions that perpetuate white supremacy. And so their work is to really look at how they're doing it, right? How am I dedicated to this? How am I perpetuating? How am I upholding? So I don't think we're necessarily saying different things. We're using different language. I'm just saying it's like all around us, right? It's inside of us. The way that I think about white supremacy inside of me is more about internalized oppression. So not internalized white supremacy, right? That's not what I'm taking in from the larger culture or the air. I'm really taking in messages about what it means to be a black woman based on what white supremacy says. And if we didn't have white supremacy, I wouldn't be internalizing racial oppression. And I often go into that as well, depending on how much time I have with people in a workshop or in a training, so I can explain more about the air we breathe in.
Next of white supremacy, again, our guest, Michelle Cassandra Johnson. You start off skill in action. You give a shout out, Jeffrey Herrick, who you say has been your biggest cheerleader. How has he supported your work? Is he classified as white or non-white?
He is white. He's actually one of my former partners. And when I wrote the list of acknowledgments, I wrote that about him because he has shown up like over and over and over, and expressed belief in my potential and capacity. Not that I needed him to do that, right? I believe in myself. But like he's expressed it in this way that's very committed. And so that's why I made a shout out to him.
Right on. When you say he's one of your former partners, what is that, like a business partner?
Well, a life partner. He's a former life partner.
Oh, okay. Like boyfriend? Is that what you mean?
Well, this is a whole other topic. Okay. But he's my ex-husband, so we were married for 12 years.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Being specific. Yes,
I know,
ma'am.
Like,
yes, ma'am.
This is a different topic. But yeah, it's fine to talk about. Yes.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. I'm not confused. Okay. And he supported your work. Outstanding.
Woo. Yes.
Moving forward. Got confused on my question that threw me off so much.
Totally fine.
Let's see. This skill in action, when you wrote this book, who was your intended audience for this book? Did you envision it for just any old body? Was it yogis? Was it non-white people, white people? Who were you thinking needs to read Skill in Action?
Well, it really came from my experience of being underrepresented in the industry of yoga and the industry of wellness and the system of wellness, which is connected to care and who's set up to be cared for and who's not. And I wrote it with the intention of it being part of yoga teacher training curriculum and all over the country and beyond. And that's started to happen, that people are requiring it for a reading for their yoga teacher training. And I think, you know, even in your intro about your own experience of hearing, like, white people say, have you heard of this person? I think that it's speaking to white people because I'm pretty direct. It's a short book. I cut through stuff real quick. I name what I think is going on, and I also offer some ideas about what we might want to do. And so I didn't write it for white people, and yet I think white yogis have not been confronted with how whiteness has infiltrated the wellness system and the industry of yoga. And so I think it came out at this time it came out in March of 2018. So I think it came out in this time where white folks were contemplating, like, how do we talk about this? How do we talk about Trump as our president? How do we work through this? How do we bring politics in? And I think it just landed at a time when white folks, they were reckoning with their whiteness. And although that wasn't my intention, I had no idea when it was going to come out, actually, when I wrote it. But I think it landed at this time when, like, there was already a culture shift beginning to happen in yoga. And it was kind of like, my book is part of the medicine about how we move forward. And it's also part of the medicine around, like, how do we have an analysis about what's happening in this industry and institution of yoga, which is like every other institution. The only difference is that yoga is a practice. And the essence of yoga is very different than how the industry operates, like as an institution, like any other institution that is racist and upholding white supremacy. And so I think there's an opportunity for us to really align with the practice and its intention through the exploration of how the industry has separated us from the essence of the practice.
For sure. Wow. In setting out your book, you contextualize yourself in talking about how you came to yoga as a black female and what the practice has done for you. You even start off in talking about growing up as a child and saying that you felt you had this alien feeling in Richmond, no less. I chuckled because I was born in Virginia, but in Richmond, no less, and saying she felt like an alien. And when are they going to come and get me out of here? Like, this place is crazy, from feeling that sense of imbalance caused by white supremacy, racism. And we kind of already touched on some of the imbalance with white people, although we can address that more. But you also talked about feeling even an imbalance with other black people who said, hey, you know, you talk white. Can you speak to some of that as well?
Yeah. My mother was a special education teacher for 32 years, but she sent my brother and I, my brother's biracial and adopted and 4 years older than I am. And she sent us to private school. And I think that was like a response to her own internalized oppression. And she thought we'd get a better education. And so what that meant is we went to private school and I was the only black girl in my class until about ninth grade. And I felt very isolated and I knew I wasn't white, nor did I want to be white. But I was like in white spaces because I was at school most of the time. When I went to ballet, I was with all black girls in ballet. And when I went to church, I was with mostly all black people, right? And so school was like, I spent 7 hours there a day. And that was sort of the norm. But I knew something was very abnormal about that setting and how I was being treated in that setting. And I had several things happen. I had white students say, you know, you are more white than I am. And I remember always being confused about that because I was very clear I wasn't white, right? I was like, that's actually not true. And when I would go to ballet, the black girls in ballet would say, you talk like you're white. And I was just like, I talk like I talk. This is how I talk. This is how and I know I was influenced by my peers. There was no intention around trying to be white, though. And the assumption was that I was trying to be white because I think we've been conditioned to think white is better. Culturally, not necessarily what you think or what I think, but the culture certainly, dominant culture certainly says white is better. And so I think all of us children, we're reacting to that conditioning and trying to figure out who we are in the middle of it, right? In the midst of that, who are we? And it was really challenging and it was really confusing because I was very awake and I was conscious and I was observant and I knew there was some system in place as a child that was making it such that I was being treated in a different way than my white peers in school. And I knew there was some system in place that was making the girls in ballet question why I talk the way I do, right? I understood that, but I didn't have language for it until I went to my first Dismantling Racism training when I was in my early 20s. I think I was 21 or 22 when I went to my first Dismantling Racism training. And that's where I gained the language and it made, and the context. And I was like, okay, I have words for what's been happening. I have words to describe racism. It's bigger than me, right? I have an understanding of why my mother as a child told me I was different, right? And I equated difference with bad. Because she would tell me I couldn't have what the other kids had, and we didn't have a lot of money growing up. And so I just internalized, okay, something about me is not good, and it must be connected to race in some way, because that's what the educational system's telling me. And now I have a much deeper understanding of what she was telling me. Like, I was walking through the world in a different way than my white peers in school, and that's what she was trying to communicate to me. So it was an interesting, challenging childhood, and it has everything to do with why I'm a Dismantling Racism trainer. It has everything to do with why I'd want to talk about racism as the lens to understand how to create justice in spiritual or yoga spaces or wellness spaces, right? It defined my path, which I'm grateful for. It was just painful at times growing up with these different messages and trying to understand who I was in the middle of this. Especially because I feel like I was wanting, I believe in liberation, and I think I knew that the messaging around me talking white, I'm making air quotes right now, and me being different or bad, right, I knew that wasn't about liberation or freedom, and the practice of yoga has been so much about, its intention, I think, is about liberation and acknowledging suffering and potentially decreasing suffering. And I think I had some awareness of that before I ever stepped onto a yoga mat or a meditation, sat on a meditation cushion. So I think it pained me that there were these fractures in relationship because of difference. And now I strive to, like, uphold difference. We're navigating in different ways. And I also want us to create liberatory spaces. Because I think, you know, if I'm not free, you're not free, and other folks aren't free. And I also deeply understand there's a system in place that has no intention of creating conditions for me to be free.
Wow. When you started your response and kind of talking about your childhood and kind of recognizing how much white supremacy disrupted relationships with people, you started with your brother, and you said that your brother, he's adopted, quote unquote, biracial. Does he have a white parent and a non-white parent?
He has a white parent and a black parent.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. And he was adopted. How did that impact your childhood? Like your brother's quote unquote biracial experience and adopted on top of that.
Yeah. Well, he was adopted before, my parents had me. And so, he was there before I was there, and it's interesting because we had a very racialized home for that reason. I mean, we just did anyway. Everyone's racialized. But we didn't talk about race that much. And I was, now in reflection, I'm curious about why. Because he was having a very different experience. He definitely looked, I would look at him and know, even if he were my brother, I would know he was mixed roots or biracial, right? I would know that about him. But I think some people look at him and they don't know. And so he's gotten the question, what are you, right? Which I think is a completely harmful, inappropriate question to ask somebody. And I've never gotten that question because it's very clear I'm black. So we definitely navigated our lives growing up in very different ways because he's light-skinned, as I said. He doesn't look white, but people aren't sure what category or box to put him in. And they never had a question about me. They just knew I was black. And so, yeah, and I'm not sure how he thinks about the things I'm talking to you about tonight or how he thinks about race. I know he knows he's black and he identifies that way. But I, you know, I don't know that he's ever been through a Dismantling Racism training or has the analysis I do or can talk about the analysis I do. I'm sure he has the analysis because he's been treated in different ways based on race. We've just had very different experiences.
Fascinating. What three books have had the largest impact on your understanding of white supremacy racism?
That's such a good question and makes me know I need to read more. The Bluest Eye, actually, Toni Morrison. It's the book that, like, I think it really taught me about internalized depression, internalized racism. And, yeah, I'll never forget it. Like, it's a book I go back to, and it just touches me deeply, the way that Toni Morrison wrote about internalized depression and blackness being seen as ugly and in comparison to whiteness, right? And I read that in school. I read that probably in middle school, so I think it just had a huge impact on my development. And I think it expanded my lens around what was going on, even though I didn't have language. It made me curious about internalized depression. Another book that has had a big impact is by one of my friends, my colleagues, Tema Okun. She's a white woman. She wrote The Emperor Has No Clothes. There's some other subtitle to that about the pedagogy of race. Or Dismantling Racism. And I worked with her for about 20 years with a group that's called Dismantling Racism Works. And she really writes about her perspective as a white woman and our process of dismantling racism and how we actually create conditions for liberation. So that's had a big impact on me as well. And the other book that had a big impact because I worked in a school is Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting in the Cafeteria Together? Or I may have said that title wrong, but it's Beverly Daniel Tatum. And I read that when I was working in a high school as a social worker, and all the black kids, they were sitting together in the high school at lunchtime. And someone recommended to me, because I was working as a social worker, I was, I think, 21 when I started working as a social worker at this high school, and that I was sent to a dismantling racism trainer later that year, a dismantling racism training later that year. And so I read that book, and then I ended up doing a bunch of equity work within the school after the training and after reading that book. So that book gave me an understanding about racial development and the different stages of racial identity development. And it also helped me understand what it must have been like for me as a child to go to a mostly white, I mean, an all-white school pretty much, and what I must have been taking in from the culture there. So those are the three books that come to mind. I have other books, but those are the three that come to the top of mind.
Reading is more important than watching television. Say that all the time on the broadcast. Every time I hear the title of that book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together? One, the thought that I had just now, that could be one response. They keep calling us nigger. The end. And that could be in the book. Yeah. We don't need to read it.
I know.
Every time I hear that title, I think the book that they need to have is Why Are All the White Kids Sitting Together? Because that is the problem. If white people were not practicing racism, there would be no need for the black children to sit together, which again would just be the other answer to that book, the end, because white people practice racism. The end.
That's true.
But the first book, very familiar. We read The Bluest Eye in our book club. That was book number 2 on the book club, way back many, 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 many years ago on the book club. What is your favorite yoga posture? Asana.
Camel pose, which is a heart opener. That's my favorite.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Ustrasana. I got a tarot card reading at our yoga retreat in Florida. And don't you know, the card, one of them was doing camel pose. I was stunned. And we did that in class this week. We did 2 rounds. We did a little break in between, let folks calm down, get their breath. We did the second round with the block in between. Remember to engage your inner thighs. Block shouldn't fall if you squeeze tightly. Let's see. Did you see the recent report? They had the exhibit, Rosa Parks in Washington, D.C., that she, I think they have her yoga mat is on display, that apparently she did a little yoga when she was not. Yes, we just played the report. Did you see this?
No, I did not.
Gotta go to the exhibit. It's Washington, D.C. They have her yoga mat. I was absolutely stunned. Like, what? Rosa Parks was practicing yoga? Like, maybe that's how she was able to stay focused, because she was doing counter-racism for the duration of her time on the planet. She did not stop in 1954. Like, to know she was a yogi as well. My goodness. Like, man, she, like, that is someone whose picture should be up. Like, when they talk about, you know, getting more images of black people up in the studio, like, bam, Rosa Parks, Yogi, like, counter-racist, yeah. Yogi. Let's
For
see.
Real.
We have asked, I think, all of the black people that we've had on that are instructors, we've asked them, like, give us a moment along the way. I'm sure you have many where racism was practiced, where you had to deal with racism. I think most people have given moments as a student. Do you have a moment as an instructor where you've had to deal with racism?
Yeah. I think, well, I don't believe in microaggressions. I think all of them are macro. And so, or they come from
twice.
The macro
Say
phase.
That twice. Say that twice.
Yes, I know, right? It's all macro. It's. I don't know why we're differentiating between the two, because harm's happening. And so, and some people would classify what I'm about to share as a microaggression. I don't, because it's tied to white supremacy. And there's nothing micro about white supremacy. And so I've had the experience several times of being, of checking in people at the front desk. And folks coming in, let's say it's a mostly white yoga studio, or run by white folks, and folks coming in and assuming that's my role. And when I go into the classroom and walk up to the front of the classroom after checking in folks, meaning like having them pay and sign up for the class, I see the look on some folks' faces, like there's dissonance. Like I'm supposed to be in the role of helping, right, and supporting and caretaking. And not in the role of teaching, because black women are not positioned as teachers very often or like authority figures in that way. Not that I'm an authority figure when I teach. There's a lot of freedom for people to move and breathe. And so I've had that happen more than one time, like the jaw drops, right? Like, oh, she's a yoga teacher. She just took my money. Like there's confusion about that for people. So I've had that experience. And then I've also had the experience of, you know, if I talk about racism in class, which I do all the time, of white people trying to explain their goodness to me and to justify like how they're different than other white people. And that feels, it feels harmful to me because I don't really have energy for that. Like I don't want to hear how a white person is different. I want to hear how a white person is doing their work. Like, I don't need to hear, I'm different than such and such and what you named about this system. No, you're part of this system and tell me how, or go talk to the other white person in the class and tell them how. So I don't have to expend emotional energy and emotional labor on affirming your goodness because you're a good white person, right? So that's the other way. I mean, there are other examples. Those are the two that rise to the top because they happen, you know, a fair amount, or they used to. I don't teach that many studio classes, and the one class I teach is just for women of color. And then I teach all over the country and lead these workshops. So I don't teach in studios very much, and I used to teach 6 to 9 classes a week in studios and would have the experience I just described more than I have now.
Context of white supremacy. She's got to be the help. She's just here to tidy the studio, and maybe they put her on the register, keeping a close eye on her, mind you. And then maybe they let her take a class for free, and then the real white instructor will come in and teach the class. Like, what? Mm-hmm. She's the instructor? What? And the second, that is exactly why I do not discuss racism if I'm teaching a class where whites are present, because oh man, they could not pay me enough nickels in the universe to have to sit and have that conversation like one time. Like everything good about yoga has been ruined. Like, no, that is exactly why I never have that conversation, because I don't want to talk about that at all. Like, let's just get back to camel pose and what we're supposed to be doing here. Let's just get back to that. I can say, as a black male instructor, because it's a super white woman dominated environment, super female dominated environment, like black male instructors are very rare, at least in my experience. I can give out of many, but one, I don't do adjustments at all. Never.
Mm-hmm.
For many reasons, yeah. I could boil that down to two words: Bill Cosby. So, I pause even if it's all black people, I still have pause. But if it's all black people, I will offer. I'm much more open to offering and doing if it's all black people. But even then, I'm hesitant. We were on our retreat in Florida. I think we had done 4 classes and I totally forgot because my normal mode is absolutely not. I'm not touching anybody. Bill Cosby. Mm-hmm. Before I remembered, oh, wow, we're on a retreat. We've been hanging out. Like, oh, I could do adjustments. I'm so sorry for forgetting to offer. Like, you know, do that. No problem. I went around and gave every extra massages for everyone. But it's like I wouldn't even think of coming in space. And this is just one reason why I went to talk to a white instructor, white male. We had taken almost 100 classes together. He knew I was an instructor. And that's rare to have an instructor you've taken that many classes with. So they can see your progress, know areas where you need to work on, all that. So I asked, going to check about my form. Like, I'm supposed to be an instructor. Like, my alignment should be, you know, reasonable somewhat if I'm going to be demonstrating postures. If you can let me know anything I need to work on. And so he's, oh, sure, no problem, blah, blah, blah. And just, you know, Sunday morning, it's fewer people, like, coming to the 8 a.m. class like you normally do. Happy to do it. I can give you adjustments if you're off or anything. He says, and somehow he veers off from that and he says, I don't even do adjustments normally. You look at somebody and they're ready to accuse you of something. And he stops and he looks at me and he says, you're black, so I can't even imagine.
Mm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
That was important for me because the audio I played at the beginning, I thought white people were ignorant about racism. You can't be ignorant about racism if you already know. Oof, it might be dangerous for me as a white male to do a lot of touching, but for you, what I just said, Bill Cosby, you had better keep your hands to yourself, which I do. I don't do any adjustments as I teach. Do you bump into other black male instructors particularly?
Not many. Not where I live, and sometimes at yoga festivals or events or gigs that I go to, but not many. No, I mean, I don't know how many black male instructors there are in the country. I mean, there are way more white female instructors than black male instructors teaching yoga. We know this. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know my experience. I don't know that experience, so I imagine it's different.
I suspect so. Still in the system of racism, but as I said, I keep my hands to myself. Let's see. Favorite pose, we got that. Ustrasana. Question. Woo. So if you were teaching and a student yelled at or said something unkind to another student in the middle of class, like, if they were making noises while they were breathing and, you know, hey, be quiet, you're making noise. Or yelled at them, hey, quiet down, you're breathing too loud. To another that they didn't know. So they're shouting this or yelling this to another student that they don't know in the middle of one of your public studio classes. How would you handle that?
And is this racialized in the sense of, like, a white person is telling a black person, don't do that? Or are you just asking in general? Because they're different.
Wow. Let's see. Would your response be different? Like, if it was just a white person saying it to another white person, would your response be different as opposed to if it was a white person saying that to a non-white person?
I mean, I think maybe not in the moment, but maybe after. So if a student, regardless of race, because all of us are racialized, but said, you're breathing too loud in the middle of class, I might offer something about us moving in different ways and breathing in different ways. And because trauma affects the breath, this is from my social work background though, like trauma affects the breath and our capacity to breathe, and certainly systems of oppression are traumatic. So I would say something about, there are different ways to breathe, different ways to be, different ways to move in this space. And, part of our practice is to make space for everyone to breathe here. In whatever way they can. Now, if the breathing is like based on entitlement and like taking up space and wanting to be seen and heard, that's why I asked about the racialized part of this, then that means somebody's not managing their energy. They're taking up energy and they're affecting everyone else in this space in a negative way. But if it's someone who is just learning like Ujjayi breath, which is breathing in and out through the nose, they may make more noise because teachers all the time, teachers will say, it sounds like the ocean. So somebody's trying to breathe to hear the ocean and they're doing it loudly, right? Like that's a different instance than me, than somebody say, like just taking it face breathing and sighing and wanting to be seen and experienced in the space. And if a white person said that to a person of color, I would probably check in with a person of color at the end of class to see how they are and if they need something or if they have questions, especially if the class was predominantly white. If it was an all people of color class or all black class, I would have a different answer for you, and I may check in a different way. So that's why I asked if it was racialized.
Gotcha. Fascinating. I'm so looking forward to hearing just from another instructor how they would even handle that situation, period. And then if it was racialized now, added. Now, this actually happened to me at the studio where I'm employed, where a white man yelled at me, "You're breathing too loud." Now, I didn't hear this. I was told about this later on. After the class, there was no check-in immediately after the class from the instructor, who was a non-white person. But I was checked in with later with the white female owner who has a signed copy of your book. It was fascinating. This was the moment that stopped me from practicing publicly. I do not practice with white people anymore after this moment. Like, I Can't Breathe took on a whole new twisted, perverted sense. And then when I read your book, especially because you spend so much time talking about breathing and how you just said how trauma is connected to breath. And even just from a yoga context, like I could, you know, Eric Garner and all of that, we can have a moment for reverence. But just from a yoga context, they say if you take 7 yoga classes a week, I would wager about 4 times you will hear your neighbor should hear you breathing. I've heard that many times in a yoga class. And sometimes they'll even do really exaggerated loud breathing like lion's breath and these sort of things where it's really loud in terms of your breath. It's not like this was a vinyasa class, by the way, for folks. This was not a yin class, meditation, relax. We're just going to lie on the floor in shavasana. This was not that at all. This was stand up, heated, moving around, headstand, that type of vigorous activity where this took place. But I say all that again. It was a non-white instructor teaching the class, which has been important because that's been very consistent. Almost without exception, the non-white instructors that function in this environment, I've only practiced in Washington State, Pacific Northwest, they function almost without exception like individuals classified as white. Meaning, I would expect if something happened in the class, I would expect them to behave the exact same way a white racist person would behave in that class, like in that situation. Like, that's what I would expect. Like, anything that happens, if a white person assaulted me, said something to me, I would not expect any sort of empathy, understanding, like, oh, we got a brother teaching the class, we got to sit. Not at all. I would think, oh no, this person is going to call the police or accuse. Like with the breathing situation, I would expect that person not to check in with me or to think, oh man, I'm so sorry he disrupted your experience breathing all loud in yoga class. We'll tell him to, you know, breathe quiet. That's what I would expect from a non-white instructor. I'm not sure. What has your experience been with the non-white and yoga instructors, black or just non-white, period?
Well, I feel like with most of the black instructors I've been in a relationship with or taught with, or just we taught at the same studio, that there's an understanding that we've been underrepresented, and that the culture of yoga, meaning the industry of yoga and the culture of wellness, has not actually positioned us to be seen as yogis. I think that varies based on someone's racial identity or ethnicity, because I think in yoga, there's also been a lot of cultural appropriation and there's been a lot of erasure of South Asian folks, so where the lineage is from. And I actually think we're in this this moment where the conversation about yoga and cultural appropriation is shifting and actually being highlighted in a different way than when I went through teacher training in 2009. Like we didn't talk about cultural appropriation. And I've been to so many yoga trainings where folks are reckoning with that or sitting with that. So I think it depends on the race and ethnicity. And I've been part of a few festivals. I don't go to many, and certainly part of many trainings that I travel around and do. And I, you know, one festival in particular that has a fair amount of Black yoga teachers, like the Black teachers go to each other's classes because we want to support each other. So there's this system of like, I'm not going to compete with you. I'm actually going to support you because there aren't many of us here. That's been my experience much more than competition or divisiveness or, strife in relationships. So that's a little bit about my experience with other teachers of color.
Wow. I'm so glad to hear that. Maybe I need to move to a different area, and I do think it's probably because the Pacific Northwest, I think you've been to the Portland area. I think there's so few Black people here, particularly, I think if you've lived here a long time, if you grew up here, white identified, that's the term that I use. You're going to be very white identified. And it's the way I would articulate it, the non-white people here who teach yoga or who spend a lot of time in the yoga environment, it's very expensive. It's very exclusive. The people that are even in that space would be kind of distinct in terms of their background and a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
But my experience, they're so white identified. They have lots of personal relationships with white people, either sexual partnerships, white friends, close emotional relationships with white people that they cannot disrupt by having any sort of honest, accurate analysis of racism on or off the mat. That has been my experience.
Mm-hmm.
To the point that I would not even feel motivated to support a Black yoga instructor unless I knew them personally, because I would expect that they would have a white sex partner or white friends, or like they have white people that are going to support them. They do not need my Black support. That's about how bad it's been. That's what I would expect here. I'm so thankful to hear that it's not like that in other places. Let's see. We do have people who had questions. I want to make space for folks if they want to get a question for Michelle Cassandra Johnson. The number here is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Let me see. I'll get in a question or two and then I'll get back to skill and action.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple more I wanted to get in. Let's see. The person who dialed in, certainly if we have any yogis, I know some of the Cows folks do practice a little bit of yoga. If we have any yogis who have questions for Michelle Cassandra Johnson, *61, we will get you on the line. Let's see. And congratulations. We had one of our Cows listeners just gave birth. Healthy baby girl.
Mm-hmm.
Prenatal yoga instructor. If they lived closer, we would have been doing some prenatal yoga together, but I did try to give tips as I could from a distance. You got to do those squats. They can be super helpful. Do those. You can do them supported. You can do them at the wall. Like, do those squats. Like, man. Anyway, she said she did them. She said that she did think that they were helpful. She said cat cow as well was super helpful. Anything you can get on your hands and knees is great. My prenatal trainer loves
it.
Get on your hands and knees. Get on your hands and knees. But she was safe. Baby is healthy. So, whoopee. Outstanding. I forgot to ask about breastfeeding and all that, but I didn't want to, pilfer with questions.
Yeah.
We'll get to that later, but hopefully they got to do the breastfeeding thing and all that. But everybody is safe and healthy. Whoopee. Let's see. Person who dialed in. Henry in Chicago, did you have a question for Michelle? You should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings. Would you like to be referred to as Michelle or Miss Johnson?
Michelle's fine.
Okay. Greetings, Michelle. I wanted to know. You mentioned that your ex husband or life partner was white. What are your thoughts about interracial marriage, dating, having sex? Between white and non-white people, what are your thoughts about that? And do you think that it is something that helps or hurts non-white people?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. And I think part of what I'm curious about around myself is how much my background of schooling, right, growing up in white spaces related to school, which then led to other white spaces connected to peers, how much that contributed to me ending up marrying a white man. I'm sure it did. And I think that contribution is different than me feeling like white is better. So I think internalized oppression or believing that whiteness is better is different than like how it's conditioned or socialized. I actually can differentiate between the two. If I couldn't, I think that would cause some psychic disturbance for me and some misalignment. And I don't necessarily, I'm a person, and I would actually say this about most things. I think there are multiple truths. And so I'm not somebody to say someone should marry this person or be with this person or have sex with this person. Like, I'm not someone to define that or prescribe that for people, because that's not my personality or way of being, because I don't know what it's like to be in another person's body. Like, I don't know what it's like to have a different lived experience. And I think if being in an interracial relationship is a way to escape from working through whatever we need to work through that's connected to our racial identity, that's probably going to cause harm in some way. And if harm is happening to the individual, harm is likely happening to the whole, meaning the collective in some way. And so I think, you know, there's some exploration that needs to happen about why, around intention, around who am I, around identity, motivation for relationship. And again, I'm not somebody who's going to prescribe what kind of relationships people need to be in, because that feels, if I do start doing that, that actually feels oppressive to me. Like, I don't actually want to engage in that. And I think we do need to be doing our work around who are we, how are we positioned, what is our location, meaning what identities do we embody, and where do we have power, and where is power taken away, and how does that change based on context? And, you know, I will say that when I was married to Jeff, that I mean, a requirement was, you need to go to Dismantling Racism before we got married. You need to go to Dismantling Racism training, and you need to go more than once. Like, I can't be with somebody unless they have some analysis about racism, about white supremacy, and about internalized oppression, because most of my work is that, meaning most of my work is to dismantle white supremacy, to deepen an understanding of racism and power and oppression and privilege and how those things operate. And if I'm working with mainly folks of color, to really understand what we're internalizing from the larger culture. And so friends and Jeff, I was like, y'all need to go to a training about this. And this is not just a training or consciousness raising. It's deep work and practice, and it's actually spiritual practice. So you need to commit to this in some way for the long haul, or I actually can't be in relationship with you in any way, romantic or otherwise. That was kind of my standard for people. And that feels really important to me, because I don't have energy to explain. Like, I mean, I get paid to explain racism, but I don't have energy in my friendship or romantic relationships to have to explain over and over how racism's real. Like, I have no energy for that. The assumption needs to be racism's real. It's hurting me in some way. If I'm with a white person in a friendship or white partner, that they're implicated in that system and perpetuating it in some way. And they need to work on understanding how. And they also need to understand they can't, like, tell me what I need to do about racism, because white folks actually have to dismantle racism. So that's a long answer to your question, but those are some thoughts about in response to your question.
All right. Gus, am I allowed to ask one more question?
Be concise. Yes, sir.
Okay. I used to work for an organization that hired Jane Elliott, and they paid her $12,000. Now, you don't have to, say how much you get paid, but is that amount close to what you're getting paid for these workshops?
No, that's not. And what I know is that even though Black folks, Indigenous folks, people of color have the we're experiencing racism. So it means we're more credible to talk about it because we're actually having the lived experience of it. That white folks are seen as more credible because whiteness is valued more and the intellect is valued more, and white folks are seen as more intellectual and intelligent. Like, I understand why Jane Elliott would be paid $12,000. I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying I have a power analysis about why that would happen and how it happens. And I've seen it happen time and time again where white folks are paying white folks, and sometimes folks of color are paying white folks to train them about racism instead of positioning the people that are most harmed by racism to teach them and to train them around it. So I think that's a result of white supremacy.
Jane Elliott, I forgot how many times she's been a guest on this program, but she's an admitted racist. That's the way she is labeled.
Mm-hmm.
Every time that is connected to a question I wanted to make sure I get to in the book. Caller, oh, I know one of them. Caller in Michigan. Black mommies are important. Get that in. Black mommies are important. Dorothy, that was your grandmother, right? I heard you talk about her in one of your interviews. Yeah, black mommies and grandmothers are important.
Mm-hmm.
8179. Did you have a? That's our mommy in Detroit, I think. Did you have a question for Miss Michelle Cassandra Johnson? Maybe I got the number wrong.
Good evening, Gus, and to the callers and listeners, and to Miss Michelle. Thanks for taking my call. I do have a question. Just in your experience, Michelle, who do you feel is most confused or most ignorant about racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works? Who do you feel is most confused, white people or non-white people, and why?
I think that this is interesting. It's a really interesting question because I have to I'm going to answer you, and I feel like I want to think about it more, so I'll just offer that caveat. I think white folks are, mm-hmm. are actually, if we're going to use the terms white supremacy, I think white folks are confused about white supremacy because sometimes they don't actually use that term to describe what's going on. So I think usually the folks who are most marginalized, the folks of color, or if we think about any system of oppression, usually the folks who are most marginalized by that system know exactly what's going on. And I think there's a lot of cultural pressure for us, all of us, white folks and folks of color, not to discuss what's happening and what's real. And the other part of this is that I don't think white folks are incentivized in any way, materially, emotionally, spiritually, physically, psychically. I'll actually take spiritual out of that. I don't think white folks are incentivized emotionally, mentally, psychically, physically, to actually be clear about how racism is operating and how they're perpetuating it. There's like no incentive because it actually means they have to look at power in a different way and they have to look at how they've been empowered by white supremacy. I think that the reason I took spiritual out of it is because I actually think, if I think about spirit myself, I think about the soul and I think about the essence of who we are. And I think we're dying because of white supremacy, all of us, at different rates and in different ways. But there's some death that happens because white spiritual death and physical death happening for folks of color because white supremacy is in place. And so I think, you know, there's a clarity around privilege, around like, if I hold the privilege, then I don't actually have to see the harm that's happening. I think that's how white supremacy operates. It's one way. So I think white folks don't actually have to see how racism is operating. They don't have to think about it if they don't want to. They don't have to talk about it if they don't want to. So there's like real clarity about that. But I think the culture puts deep pressure on us to actually normalize white supremacy and for white folks in particular to normalize white supremacy. So I think there's confusion that happens because of the cultural pressure. And then there are some white supremacists who are proclaimed white supremacists, proclaimed racists, who are intentionally perpetuating white supremacy. And I think folks of color, we are, myself included, can be confused as well because of what we're internalizing from the culture. So I take in messages about what it means to be black all the time from culture, from dominant culture. They're negative messages that I'm taking in. And if I'm not clear about who I am and about a power analysis, then I can just replicate oppression with other people of color. And I see that happen all the time. And I was actually thinking that's about what you said earlier around the Pacific Northwest. I lived in Portland, Oregon for 1 year, and I saw that happen a lot, that there's this dissociation from other people of color because of internalized oppression and because of living in a place where there aren't many folks of color, which is like in deep contrast to the South where I'm from, right? I'm from Virginia. I'm from North Carolina. So very different settings. So I think folks of color can be confused too. But I think the culture works really hard to and powerfully to make white people confused about white supremacy.
Okay. I have one more question. You mentioned this training. Is it dismantling racism training? Mm-hmm. Is that the training? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, who's the majority, people that attend this training? Is it white people or non-white people? And what is the training? Like, can you just kind of share a little bit of information on what's the training?
Yeah. So I'll say that the audience, it changes based on region. That's been my experience with it, that sometimes in different parts of the country we have more people of color, and then sometimes we have predominantly white folks. And also whatever's going on culturally, like the election of Trump, we had a lot more white folks signing up for dismantling racism training. So the culture will influence people's behavior. We know this, right? And so it meant, like, at different times, more white people will show up, more folks of color will show up, depending on what people need and what's going on and how they're responding to culture. And the training is really, there are two different things that happen. So I've led community training, which means going in for 2 days. Usually I'm in a biracial training team, so I'm with a white trainer and myself. And sometimes I'm with other trainers. So it's a group of trainers, some white, some folks of color. And we just do a training that's about consciousness raising. So it's about personal, institutional, and cultural racism. I also work with organizations over time. So organizations that sign up for a year-long process or a six-month process or an 18-month process where they're actually making a commitment to creating race equity or dismantling white supremacy within their organization. And that's more than a training. And I always say with organizations that the work starts after the training. The training is just conscious. It's just like, here's what personal racism is. Here's what institutional racism is. Here's what cultural racism is. Here's some examples. Here's the history and how race was constructed over time. Here's what internalized oppression is and internalized white supremacy is. And there's some caucusing. So we break out into groups of folks of color, which I'll lead if I'm the trainer there, and a white caucus where a white person will lead that, and then we come back together to talk about next steps. So the training is really consciousness raising. It's really let's shift the paradigm, or let's uncover what's true. And for some people that's revolutionary, and for others they know what's true. They're coming for affirmation, or they're coming because they want their friend or colleague to be a different way. I see that in trainings a lot. I really think that if we're going to actually dismantle racism, or I'm going to dismantle internalized oppression, that I actually need to commit to that for the long haul. And it can't happen in just a two-day training. That's just one piece of the practice. People need to engage.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call. One last question about the training. So if I have would you encourage white people to attend this training to
absolutely
to help
yes.
them? Okay. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you for taking my call, and I will mute myself.
Yes,
thank
ma'am.
You.
Good to hear from you, caller in Michigan, caller in VA. I think she was with us for the yoga retreat, although she missed the sweet potato pie. Caller in Virginia, are you with us?
I am. Greetings, everyone.
Greetings.
I have two questions. One is a yoga question, and one is a question about your training. The yoga question is, can you explain the difference? You guys touched on it, but maybe you could share a little bit more about the difference between vinyasa and yin. I started a new gym, and they have both classes that are offered. So that's my first question. And then my second question for Michelle is, how do you confront white people during the trainings to get them to speak out about their own racism, because I've noticed in these kinds of diversity training or some kind of anti-racist training that white people tend to get very quiet and they don't speak out.
Mm-hmm.
So do you experience that, or do you do most of the talking, or do you get them to actually verbalize how they're feeling or what they're thinking? I'll mute.
Thank you for your question. So as far as I understand, and you can, Gus, you can certainly add to this. I was trained in a power yoga. My 200-hour training was a power yoga training, and it was based on vinyasa, which is moving. Vinyasa actually means transition. It's how we actually place the parts of our body from one posture to another. So it's like where I place my hands when I'm moving from a posture child's pose, which is close to the ground, to tabletop position, which is just pressing down through your hands and your knees and your feet. And so that's actually what vinyasa means. But when people use it to describe a class, they're talking about flowing from one posture to the next. So there are many different lineages of yoga. Yin is a different lineage of yoga than vinyasa yoga. And vinyasa actually comes from Ashtanga, which is a set sequence. Vinyasa is not. And you'll just flow with the breath. So on an inhale, you'll move in one way. On an exhale, you'll move in a different way. So you can feel the, it is very flowy. You can feel that happening. And some yoga lineages, you're just holding postures. And so yin, which I've been trained in, and I teach yin is where, so vinyasa is flow, and vinyasa is more yang. So it's more heat. Yin actually is supposed to be a cooling practice, but I actually think it causes some heat to happen emotionally, because usually in yin, you're holding postures for 5 minutes or longer. They're not like, I don't know if you're familiar, which postures you're familiar with, but they're not like a warrior one pose or a tree pose. Most of them are close to the ground. Some of them are hip openers. And you're often people are well supported if they have access to props in a yin class, where they're just sitting in it. And I don't want to say surrendering, because I'm real careful about how I use that word, but I think like people are going inside, inward, in a very different way than a flow class can feel for people. So there's a much more reflective quality in my experience, and this is different for everyone, in a yin class than in a vinyasa class. Like, transformation happens in vinyasa, and I love that practice. And I think deep reflection and going inside happens in a yin practice. And they're going to feel real different. So I would actually say maybe you take both and see, or actually have a practice with both. Like, you take vinyasa one day and you take yin 3 days later, and you just see how they feel, because they're going to, they complement each other. I think they do, or they can. And I will say, if your gym has restorative yoga, that's actually the direct complement to a flow yoga class. Again, because I think yin builds heat emotionally, just not necessarily physically, because people have to sit with the resistance that, and this is such a metaphor for transformation and anti-racism work, people have to sit with the resistance that arises when we are like holding a posture, when we are committing to something, when we are in it, when we're investing in it. People have to sit with that, because the body really wants to resist that, and it wants to move out of it. It wants to move to something else that maybe feels comfortable or offers the illusion of comfort. So that's the yoga answer. And then I'll tell you how people describe me. People describe me as direct and compassionate. I'm definitely led by the heart. That's very different than politeness, or loving everyone, or caretaking everyone, right? I have an open heart, and I also have a fierce heart. And I'm very direct, because I don't have time to sugarcoat things, to be polite about things, or to be politically correct. I have no time for that. We don't have time for that. And so I will directly, at times, confront white people in a training. I will respond if they're causing harm in the space, and actually name harms happening, and here's how I see it. This is how I'm feeling. Are other people feeling this way? I will also ask white people to locate themselves, which really means, it means a couple different things, but in this example, it means if it's a white person, saying, I'm confused, but I'm in the conversation. I'm fully present. I'm listening. I'm positioning myself as a learner. I'm here. I'm confused, or I'm learning, or I'm learning something new in this moment, and I want you to know I'm here for it, but I don't know what to say right now. We live, in my experience, we live in a culture that doesn't actually teach us to tell the truth about how we're feeling. And so I just offer that skill from the beginning. And the other thing I do in trainings is I say, you're going to feel uncomfortable. People of color are going to feel uncomfortable. White folks will feel uncomfortable. The way we feel discomfort is different based on our own experience of trauma and based on our lived experience. And white folks, I will say this, can sustain discomfort of some amount when we're in a conversation and training in a space talking about dismantling racism. Because I always say being a black woman is uncomfortable for me most of the time in the culture. I don't feel uncomfortable with my identities, but the culture certainly is set up to make me feel discomfort about who I am and to make me feel uncomfortable when it perceives I'm out of place. So I'm just direct about all the things I just named. And I mean, you really have to probably experience me to feel this and see what I'm, or experience, you know, like understand what I'm describing. My role in a facilitation is not to caretake white folks. I do try to hold the group and stay in relationship with the group. And if harm is happening, then I'm going to interrupt it because I feel like I have a duty to do that, especially to folks, for folks of color in the space if white folks are causing harm. So I'll interrupt people. I'll disrupt what's happening. I'll ask a question that's about curiosity, right, that invites in curiosity for someone. I'll ask one to practice discernment, to sit with what they're going to say before they say it and see if they actually need to say it, because whiteness doesn't teach white people that. Like, discernment's not a practice that whiteness upholds. It teaches white people to be right and to know the answer. And so I'm really teaching something different. You don't know the answer because you don't know this lived experience. So why don't you sit with what you're about to say and see if you actually need to say it? So those are, I just named a few things that I do. And thanks for the question.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Much obliged, caller in Virginia. Keep cooking the plant-based yumminess. Let's see. Is this Ivy? Did you have a question for Michelle? You should be with us.
Yes, I do. Greetings, Dash. Greetings, Michelle. Greetings to all the callers on the line. Michelle, is it your view that non-white people are to blame at all for racism?
Do I feel that non-white people are to blame for racism? Is that the question? Just so I'm clear. Is that what you asked?
Because you mentioned implication, but not in the same way as white people. Is it your view that non-white people are to blame for racism at all?
So I think that without white supremacy, we wouldn't have racism. And white people constructed white supremacy. And I'm implicated because I can go along to get along. And I can believe I should assimilate into a system. And all that happens when I assimilate is that my soul gets crushed and I step on other people of color because I believe the institution is out to support me and it isn't. It hasn't been constructed for my liberation. And so I think non-white folks are responsible for perpetuating internalized oppression, for distancing from each other, for supporting the hierarchy around race, for perpetuating colorism, for example. That's one way that we distance, right? And the hierarchy around, for folks of color, is only present and in relationship to the hierarchy around race and how it was constructed, which again was constructed by white people. So I think, you know, I always differentiate in my definition of racism that I offered earlier. My folks, black people, have not been backed by social and institutional power. We weren't backed by wealth. We didn't build the wealth the same way we don't as white people. We weren't given access to making the decisions in institutions. We weren't given access to constructing institutions or cultural norms around race. And so what that means is when I'm being prejudiced, I can be prejudiced against white people. I say this all the time in training. But it's not backed by social and institutional power, which means it's something different than racism. It's race prejudice. It's being mean. It's being unkind. It's being heartless, right? Like, we can participate in that. And I also say what that means is folks of color can perpetuate internalized racism. But again, that's only present because white supremacy is present. And white supremacy has created conditions that give us messages as people of color that we're not good. I don't believe that about myself, but the culture sure as hell tells me that, like, all the time. That's what I look at when I go to the news. That's what I see when I interact with the educational system, with the housing system, with banking. The messages are that I'm untrustworthy, that I'm not good, that I'm irresponsible, right? Those are messages that I get about being Black all of the time. While white people get messages about being good and pure and moral, and trustworthy, which is interesting to me because there's nothing about whiteness that I should trust. And I'm differentiating between white people and whiteness, the system of whiteness. So I think we're responsible for causing harm. And I think we need to notice, like, who we're being accountable to. And I think we need to understand when we are actually creating conditions for white supremacy to thrive by distancing from other people of color and by belittling the experience of other people of color. And as folks of color, we're not all having the same experience. Black is at the bottom of the hierarchy of race. Not a hierarchy I created, but a hierarchy that white supremacy created. So anti-Blackness is a real thing. It's playing out. So the experience of being closer to white is very different than the experience of being Black. And one skill that I think is useful is for folks who are closer to white or white adjacent is another term people will use, is to understand that their adjacency to whiteness is currency. It's more valuable. And then to think about how they use that in spaces where there are Black folks, because Black's at the bottom of the hierarchy. That's a long answer, but that's my answer to your question.
Okay, so is that a yes, that non-white people are to blame for racism?
No, it's not. It is a, here's what I don't think we're to blame for racism, because I don't actually think we are positioned to be racist. I think we're positioned to perpetuate internalized racism. And I think white people constructed racism. And so I think white people are, as I said, and you said, implicated in perpetuating it. And what people of color are doing is perpetuating internalized oppression. That's how I would differentiate the two. I think we can do lots of things as people of color and non-white folks. But we have not been positioned to be racist because of social and institutional power. That's not how we've been set up. We don't benefit from this system of racism, and white people benefit every time. But we don't. But they benefit materially, emotionally, not spiritually, again, because of what I explained earlier. We're dying because of this. But, like, they benefit. There are very clear benefits we can name that white people are experiencing. And I don't think we can name the same thing. I don't think the same thing is true for non-white folks.
Okay, because when I hear the term implicate, I think of the term blame. So when you say implicate, you're not saying we're implicated in racism or white supremacy. You're saying we're implicated in something else, correct?
In a system, yes. Thank you for saying that. We're implicated in this white supremacist system, but we're not white supremacists, non-white people, right? And I would say that white people are, I'm not going to say all white people are white supremacists. What I do want to say is that they're internalizing white superiority. And I'm not internalizing that. I'm internalizing something very different, the opposite, in fact, inferiority. And so I used implicated to say I'm part of the system, but I'm part of it in a very different way. And my part means that I can fracture relationships with people of color because I'm taking in messages that people of color are bad. I don't believe that, but, like, that's the message I'm getting from culture. And I'm part of this system because if I'm not clear about an analysis about power, I can step on people of color. I can say I'm better than. I can say if you work hard like I did, you'll get to where I am, which is, it's so connected to meritocracy, the myth of meritocracy and white supremacy, and competition and individualism. And so implicated is really like me just owning, I can't escape this white supremacist system because of the culture we live in, but I'm not perpetuating white supremacy. I may be harming other people of color unintentionally, and I think some folks of color harm other folks of color intentionally. I'm not trying to do that, but I can't escape it. It's because it's how the culture has been made. I can be really mindful about how I engage in this system, which is what I try to do through my work. So thanks for your question.
Yes, ma'am. And I just, my last question real quick is that, you stated that white people don't have to think about racism and that they are confused about it. How have white people been dominating for centuries if they're confused about racism and if they don't have to think about it? I think about a game where someone has been blown out. It would seem that the team that has been losing and that got blown out by 50 points or lost the championship or whatever it may have been, that they were the confused ones, and that the people who were dominating, they're the ones, they had to think about it, and they had to, they couldn't possibly be confused, because otherwise how can they dominate and dominate for so long? And that was it. I'll mute my line. Thank you for taking my questions.
Thank you for asking. I think that some white folks are very clear that they're dominating and that there's a history of domination, and they want to hold on to that power. And I think some white folks would never describe themselves as being dominant in that way, or part of a system of dominance. That's what I think some are confused. And white privilege means that white folks are privileged enough, right, in this way where they don't actually have to think about racism consciously, even if they're benefiting from it materially, that they don't have to call it racism. They can call it hard work. They can call it merit. They can call it, I earned this, right? I deserve this. I'm entitled to this. But they don't have to call it racism or dominance, right, or superiority. And so, to be clear, yes, there are white folks who believe in dominance and who would frame it that way. And who I encounter in a yoga and social justice training or dismantling racism training is a white person who's saying, I'm not part of that system. I have no intention of dominating people because they haven't been conditioned to look at the ways in which they're benefiting from the system of dominance. Meanwhile, I can see how they're benefiting, but they're not, unless they are in a practice of self-awareness and of cultural awareness, there's no incentive, as I said earlier, for them to look at what's really happening, because they can go along, they can get by. We can't, as folks of color, and so are non-white people. And so I feel like I've encountered several confused white people, and part of that's because they don't know, or they act like they don't know, or they've never had to know, or no one's ever called them on it, or they've not been in a sustained relationship with a person of color where they've like had to work through this, or they haven't lost a person of color, right, in a relationship where they've had to work through this. So I think I've encountered, that's what I would frame as confusion. Perhaps it's willful ignorance. I don't know. Like, maybe there's no difference between the two. I do know that I am, you know, I have identities that are privileged. So I'm middle class, I'm heterosexual, I have a master's degree, I'm a citizen, right? So I have identities that mean that if I'm not clear, I can just think of my identities as the norm. And I can say everyone else has access to this when they don't. And so I'm not confused, but there's stuff that I don't know because I don't have other people's lived experiences from those vantage points of privilege, or the opposite of the identities I named, the identities that are oppressed because I'm privileged, right? I'm able-bodied. I don't have a disability. I don't actually have to think about those things because they don't inform how I navigate through the world. White people are not conditioned to see themselves as white. That's one of the toxicities in culture. And so they can walk around confused about their whiteness because they're never asked to look at it. Culture never asks them to do that. It's only like other people or their workplace that's doing a dismantling racism training or their, right? Like there's nothing about whiteness that asks white people to look at their whiteness. Nothing. And so that's what I mean when I say confusion. And I agree, like there are people, some people who are very clear about what they're doing. I'm not naive about that, and calculated, and benefiting. And again, maybe it's willful ignorance and not confusion, but thanks for your question.
Much obliged, Ivy. Before we nab our next caller, overlap between counter-racism and yoga. I was stunned in becoming a yoga instructor. They spend a lot of time about being precise with words and thinking about words. I had an instructor that said you should sit down and think of a list of verbs for your cueing, and different verbs that you can think of. Elevate, raise, lift, and just really paying attention. Filler words. Are you saying a lot of unnecessary things? Michelle talks about that in Skill in Action, where you have silence, where you're not just chatting away as an instructor, where you make space for silence, paying attention to words. On this broadcast, Context of White Supremacy, we do not use the word privilege. Just make note for listeners, when we've had guests on, when the word privilege comes up. I think that happened with Clifford Thompson recently. One other quick point before we get our next caller. I have concluded whiteness is white people. Just like I said with institutions before, there are lots of different ways where it ends up deviating from. At the end of the day, it is Rob, Susan, Donald, practicing racism, white supremacy. Whiteness is white people, unless I've been misinformed. Caller, victim of racism in New Jersey. Did you have a question for Michelle Cassandra Johnson?
Yes. Good evening, everybody. You spoke of not having the energy to explain racism, and I'm sure it takes a lot of patience. If you encounter, have you ever encountered a non-white black person that was confused about racism, thought racism didn't exist, or even worldview was that of a conservative worldview, and you know that was very white identified? And if so, how did you deal with that, and did you have any patience in that conversation, or would you show any patience if you ever encountered that particular black person?
Yeah, thank you for your question. So I want to clarify. I also said I get paid to define racism and talk about it. So I do have energy in that it's part of my work. It's part of my practice in the world. And outside of those spaces where I've been hired to or chosen to be in space where I'm having a dialogue across difference or even just with other black folks about race, outside of those spaces, I don't have a lot of energy because it takes so much energy to hold space or facilitate in the way I do. And so I definitely, I'm sure I have encountered black folks who believe in reverse racism, or are saying they do. I'm not actually always clear they do when they're saying it, because when I've heard it, it's been in the context of a dismantling racism training. And I have to think about if those trainings, the ones I'm thinking about with black folks who've said reverse racism is real, if those have been predominantly white. And I have to think about if the black folks have been in space with their boss, who's white, right, and if they're caretaking. But I have encountered black folks who are not clear about the definition of racism. And that makes sense. I was never told the definition of racism. I was told the definition of racism when I was 20, the definition I offered when I was 21 or 22. In school, I was told that it's about getting along with other people. And that I'm as responsible growing up, like, I was as responsible as my friend Allison Warner in school, who was white, to respond to racism. That's not true, right? Like, that's not real, but that's what I was taught. And so I had to go learn a different definition of it so I understand confusion. And, you know, I have a lot of, I mentioned compassion earlier. I have a lot of compassion. And I have this skill of seeing people's conditioning, and what I mean is the messages we're taking in just by being alive at this time based on identity and the meaning culture makes of identity. So I have an awareness that we're being conditioned to think a certain way, to be a certain way, to breathe a certain way, to move a certain way. And in moments, I can actually see the conditioning and separate that from someone's individual humanity. And that gives me a lot of patience and a lot of energy, and it makes space for relationship. I'm not always able to do it, but I've gotten much better at it. And it actually came about from talking to a white person in a training who was doing something harmful, and I intervened.
And I said, I can see your conditioning. Whiteness has taught you to do this. And I know you're bigger than what whiteness has taught you to do, period. And then we moved on. Like, that's it. That's what I believe. And so when Black folks say things like reverse racism is real, or they minimize the impact of racism, I know that's coming from either a place of conditioning, a place of protectionism, a place of deep trauma or harm, a place of, I don't know what the consequences are going to be if I actually speak out about this in this space. Like, I know there's something deeper there. So I try to stay in relationship, which does take energy, but it also feels like, in that case, with Black folks and people of color, my responsibility. Like, part of my work is healing myself because of the internalized racism I've experienced and that I contend with. And part of my work is to create conditions for healing, conditions so that other people of color can heal. I think that's part of my practice. I don't necessarily feel the same way about white folks. Like, I'm a healing practitioner, so I'm going to create a healing space regardless of who's in it and regardless of what we're talking about. But I know the damage of racism and trauma of racism is much deeper for me as a Black person and for other folks of color. So I'm going to spend more energy thinking about conditions for healing for us. And white folks, if I'm in a biracial training team, white folks can work with white folks around that. And if I'm not, I'm going to create conditions for healing in general, but I'm going to pay attention to the folks of color in the room much more than the white folks.
Gotcha. So you'll have more patience.
Yeah.
With Black people. Okay. Last question. Then I'll mute myself. In your relations, you said that your ex-husband was supportive. So you have family and extended family. Was his family aware of your work? And if so, how supportive were they?
They were aware of my work. And I think, I'm thinking about myself in the sense of like who I am. And so I think that, I think they were supportive, and I also was going to do my work regardless of what they thought. And so I didn't pay a lot of attention to what they thought about it. Like, I was never looking for their approval. I wasn't looking for his approval. My mother taught me to be my own person and to do what I believed in and to be connected to the things we've been talking about, like change and transformation and liberation. And I learned that from her, and care, like a culture of care. I learned that from my mom for sure. And so, yes, they were supportive, and yes, I would do what it was never about them. You know, it's like, this work has always been about something bigger than me, but it's not been about affirmation from other people because it feels so rooted and connected to my, rooted in and connected to my dharma, my duty, my practice in the world, what I'm here to do. Like, it feels so rooted in purpose that often I don't get caught up in what other people think about it. It doesn't mean I'm like I can make mistakes and I'll take feedback. Certainly I will. But if I get caught up in what everyone thinks about the work I do, then I won't do the work. And I'm here to do, like, I'm really here to do work. I'm here to practice. I'm here to change what's going on. I'm here for liberation. And so, yes, they were supportive. And also, I'm me, and I'm going to do what I believe I'm meant to do here on this planet in this lifetime. And thanks for your question.
Oh, thanks a lot. Enjoy the rest of your night. One more question.
Oh, hang on.
I'm
just trying to get our listeners. If it's just for me, can we get it after we get through the rest of the callers? We'll make sure we make time.
Okay. No problem.
Much obliged. Thank you for your patience, sir. Patience. Caller at 9029. Did you have a question for Michelle?
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, all the callers and listeners. And thank you, Ms. Johnson, for coming on the program tonight. I have a couple of questions. This is in regards to the breathing you were speaking about trauma and how it affects the breathing. Can you go a little bit into that as far as, like, how it affects people from day to day? Just wanted to get some input on that.
Yeah, so in my book, In Skill and Action, I share some personal narrative about my birth And when I was born, I couldn't breathe. I was 2 pounds and 3 ounces. I couldn't breathe. My mother was given anesthesia so that they could do an emergency C-section. She'd already been through the trauma of a stillbirth 2 years before she had me. The afterbirth came out before me, and I would not come out. And so they did this emergency C-section. And my mother, and this is what I have written about in the book, she woke up to no baby because I was taken to a hospital across town. And interestingly enough, she's in that hospital right now. She's been ill. Just saw her today there. And so I was taken away from her because there was no preemie unit in the hospital where I was actually taken out of her, right, born, birthed. And I didn't really know that story until I wrote the book. I knew that I was sick. I knew that I was 2 pounds and 3 ounces when I was born, but I didn't know the full story. And so during the course of writing the book, I asked her my birth story. And this is connected to the breath because, one, I told you I couldn't breathe when I came out. But also I remember the day, this is after Eric Garner was murdered by the police, I choked. I looked at the video, and I really have a habit of not doing that because it so deeply, like, distresses me. It's not that I know it's real, but I'll dream about it. I'll be disrupted for days. I won't be able to sleep. So I really have a habit of not watching, but more listening, like hearing, okay, this is going on in the world. I know racism's happening. I know it's happening in these ways. It has been, right? And so for some reason, I sat in my office in between social work clients, and I watched this video, and I went in to teach yoga class that same day. And in the opening meditation, I said, oppression takes the breath away. And I had never said that prior to that moment. Like, it just came out of me in a meditation. And I knew it was about Eric Garner, and I knew it was about me not being able to breathe when I was birthed, and I knew it was about having asthma, which I've had since I was 4 years old. So I have the physical experience of the breath being constricted. And I knew enough about racism and my own experience as a Black woman to understand that racism constricts my breath. And in fact, that it really wants me not to breathe. White supremacy does not want me to breathe. And racism is a product of white supremacy. Doesn't want me to breathe. And I started to talk about the breath as, like, life-giving and liberatory. And the awareness that, you know, everyone does not have the space to breathe. And part of my practice is to know that. Because that will change how I am in the world, if I know that. It's not just about an inhale and exhale. Like, the breath is actually about liberation. It's about being alive, right? When we don't breathe, when we stop breathing, we're not alive physically anymore. Energetically, we are, but we're not alive physically. And so the breath just became such a central part of the book and of just who I am and how I talk about my experience. Because I think on a cellular level, I understood that I couldn't breathe when I was born, when I actually told the class about Eric Garner and the fact that oppression takes the breath away. I think I was remembering what it was like to be born 2 months early in a 2-pound, 3-ounce body, and I wasn't able to breathe. Like, I think I remembered that in that moment. And trauma, from being a therapist for years, I know trauma disrupts the nervous system. And when the nervous system's disrupted, we can't regulate our breath. And yoga is so much about regulating the breath and change the breath, actually having the capacity to change the way we think and the way we behave. And the breath has the capacity to bring us back home to who we are, our true nature, whatever you want to define your true nature as. The breath has the capacity to bring us home to that. Oppression is actually intended to take us away from that. Power or abuse of power is intended to take us away from that. Like, that's its intent. So I think the breath is everything. And it's why I include embodied practice in a dismantling racism training. It's why I start with a meditation in a boardroom with folks who are going to learn about racism. Because we have to come back to the body and the breath. And we have to remember the experience of breathing deeply. And we have to know that everyone does not have the experience or space to breathe. And in this time where Eric Garner in particular is saying, I can't breathe, that was poignant for my students when I said it. They knew exactly what I was talking about. Because culturally, politically, we had just heard someone die saying, I can't breathe. And there's no way to escape from that. Like, they couldn't go anywhere. They're in unseated meditation. There was nowhere for them to go but to sit with the discomfort of what it means or meant that a man was choked to death saying, I can't breathe. A black man was choked to death saying, I can't breathe. Like, so that's, I mean, obviously I'm talking about it with deep passion because it feels so deep to me, the breath, because it's life. And we need to learn how to breathe, and we need to make space for people to breathe. And we need to find our breath that's been taken away. If we're folks of color, right, and have been oppressed, we need to reconnect to the breath, and we need to heal through the practice of breathing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I only have two more questions real quick.
Pick your most important. Most important.
Will do, sir. This is in regards to poses in the morning. I've recently been really getting some real good rest at night, so I'm able to wake up and do some stretching. And I practice at home mainly. I sometimes go to a studio, but mainly at home. In the morning, what are some poses that would be ideal for stretching for morning?
Yeah. So I sort of have two different answers. So one is that sun salutations, meaning, you know, saluting the sun and moving with the breath and waking up the body and that sun energy and that fire can be a really useful practice in the morning. The other thing I want to say is that most times people's bodies are not awake in the morning. And so sun salutations are typically they're not slow. And so the body might actually need something much slower to ease into the day. And that, I just mean moving through postures in a slower way. It could still be a sun salutation. It could still be a mountain pose and folding forward and flowing through a vinyasa and landing in table or down duck, whatever your sun salutation is, or floor salutations, right? It could be something like that. You might just take more time with it to really sense the body and to move in a way that really wakes up the body, but not in a forced way and not in a furious, like a fast and furious way. And the other thing I want to name is there's a teacher, I love her. Her name is Tracy Stanley, and she lives in California, and she teaches Yoga Nidra, which is deep rest and relaxation. And she actually said the best time to practice Yoga Nidra is to do it in the morning. And in a Yoga Nidra, it's a guided meditation where you're going through different parts of the body, and you're focusing on them. And you're also setting what's called a Sankalpa, which is an affirmation in the present tense. And you're talk about coming home to yourself. That Sankalpa is intended to help you do that. And so she really says it's rest, it's not sleep, and that it's good to do it in the morning because you're really setting your intention for the day and how you want to be and who you want to be. So Tracy Stanley is her name, and you know, if you're interested, you could look her up because she has some yoga nidras that are free and accessible to people. And I feel like she's like medicine, like these yoga nidras are medicine for people, because I also think the culture doesn't let us rest enough. And often people are sleep deprived and we actually may need more rest, but in an intentional way, in the morning. So there's some ideas.
Much obliged. Thank you, sir. Love it. Love it. Love it. Let's see. Person who called in. Thomas in New York. Did you have a question for Michelle? You should be with us.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the guest, Michelle. I had a few questions. I'm going to try to get to the most important ones. I heard the term, and I hate this term, but I heard it when Gus used to describe your work, the word social justice. Is that what you do?
Well, I started to talk about my work as you know, working at the intersection of justice or social justice and yoga, and in particular racial justice, because that's what I lead with. And I actually did that
can
when
you
I
just give me a can you give me a definition for social justice?
I think it's creating conditions for everyone to thrive. Like at its, you know, essence, I have more to say about it, but that's what I would say. But injustice means that some of us aren't thriving and we're suffering. And justice means there are conditions in place for all of us, for equity to happen, because we start in different places, and for all of us to thrive and to have self-determination about those conditions, because what I need to thrive may be different than what you need. And so that's what I mean when I say justice, because great injustice has happened, and we know how. So it's a response to that. And it's social for me in the sense of that it's more than personal. It's cultural. You could substitute cultural for social, right? It's like something has to happen on a cultural scale, in my mind, for us to create conditions for folks to thrive, be able to thrive. And there's a text called the Bhagavad Gita, which is it's a yogic text, and it's about actionable yoga. And it's about the principles that we live into to actually create it's about the principles we live into to live into our dharma. So it's about what we need to practice to live into our purpose and to take action. And the implication in that text is that we have to take action if we're alive. And when I think about justice, in my mind, it's about taking action instead of sitting around watching people die and not doing anything about it. And so that's what deeply resonated with me about the Bhagavad Gita is, it is actionable. It's not just philosophy. It's like you have to do, you are compelled to do something because you're alive in a body. And here's a practice that's going to help you do something. And everyone has something different to do, but we have to take action. And so that's the other thing I would couple with what I said to you about justice and social justice that influenced me.
Gotcha. Okay. It's just the social part I have issue with, but I got your definition.
Last question.
Would you classify your ex-husband as a racist?
I would classify him as a racist because of my definition of racism, yes. And the definition of racism? No, I don't have any children. The definition of racism...
You say that your experience growing up with the quote-unquote mixed-race brother is the reason why you didn't have children with a white man? That's my last question.
No. The reason I didn't have children, I was about 8 or 10, and I was driving across the James River in Richmond, Virginia with my mom, and I said, "Mom, I don't want to have kids." And I said it because I knew something was deeply misaligned about the world. And Gus, you mentioned it when there's a part in my book where I was like, the aliens need to come get me out of here because something is wrong. I knew in my body that something was deeply wrong and traumatic about the world. And I felt it. And so I made a decision then not to have kids. And I was 8 or 10. So I was like, very young when I looked at my mom and said that. And she just looked at me and said, "Don't say that." Like she was sort of like, "Why is this child telling me this right now?" But I just knew we were in trouble. It's not the only thing I believe about the world. I think we're resilient and we're joyful too, but like politically, culturally, we're in trouble. We've been in trouble. The history of race construct, the race construct has caused a lot of harm to people, and white folks have benefited from that. And so I just knew that. And that's why I decided not to have kids. And I did decide that if I was going to have a kid, which I don't, I would adopt them because my brother's adopted and there are plenty of children who need to be adopted, but I never did that. So I've kids in my life, like just that I know, but I haven't birthed any children or I don't have any children I caretake. Because I just contemplating bringing a child into the world, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. So let me be real clear. Like people have their babies, but like, I just felt like I want to try to fix what's misaligned or try to address it in some way. That's my contribution and legacy, different than me birthing a child and that being my legacy.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Retired firefighter, did you have a question for Michelle? You should be with us.
Yes, sir, Gus. I got your back. I will be short. logically, do white people need non-white people to solve this problem?
No. White people have to solve racism and white supremacy. That's my answer. But we didn't create it.
Okay.
And we are not going to be the ones that dismantle white supremacy. Again, I've differentiated. We may dismantle internalized oppression, but we're not going to dismantle white supremacy because we didn't create it. And so we have a responsibility to each other as humans and humanity, but we're not going to dismantle that system. White people need to dismantle it. It's the only way it's going to crumble.
Yes. Is the assumption of white, quote-unquote, ignorance, something that I do not use, put those two words together, is the assumption of white ignorance a dangerous practice under the system of white supremacy racism, assuming that white people are ignorant?
I think it causes harm to assume that white people are ignorant, and I think...
But do you think it's dangerous? Do you think it's very, very dangerous for non-white people to assume that there are some white people who are ignorant about the system of racism, white supremacy?
I think it's dangerous to non-white people, yes. To assume that.
Thank you. That's it.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Blue, he was with us in Florida for the retreat. He did not miss the sweet potato pie. Did you have a question for Michelle?
Yes. Good evening, callers. Greeting to the host and greeting to Michelle. My question is, based on the history of violence suffered by non-white people globally, and also non-white people, specifically non-white black people, do you think that we as non-white people should suspect all white people of practicing racism?
I think that based on my definition, yes. I think that in some way, because of how whiteness works, all white people are practicing racism. And I think that some people, white folks, have a plan about how to do that. And I think other white folks are doing it through their lack of awareness of the benefits they're receiving from whiteness, but still going along with it, right? So, yeah. I mean, my definition does not implicate people of color. Meaning it does not say folks of color are racist. It says white folks have been positioned to be racist and are benefiting from the racist, from white supremacy, and sort of differentiating between the two. So, yeah.
And lastly, do you think within the practice of yoga, do you think that non-white people should also train, have firearms training based on the history of violence perpetuated by white people in America and abroad, or globally?
I don't. That's a really interesting question, and I don't know. That's what I'm going to say. I'm certainly not opposed to that, and I'm also. It's not something I've sat and thought about very much. Or something I would go to, right? Like, but I would understand why non-white people would want that kind of training, right? Like, look at the context. I understand that. I'm not sure that's anything I would do, and I'm not judging that other people do that. I'm just saying to you, like, it's not my orientation to be trained in that way. And I'm not saying that it's wrong for anyone else, meaning other non-white people, to be trained in that way, the way you're naming.
Thank you very much, Michelle. I'll mute my line.
Mm-hmm.
Much obliged, Mr. Blue. We did plant-based meals, vegan sweet potato pie, yoga every day, and we went to the gun range twice in Florida. Have been shooting every time at the yoga. I don't even think there are black counter-racist yoga retreats where there is shooting included, and we've done it twice. Caller Imhan DC, I think this will be our last caller. I think we got them all. Imhan DC, did you have a question for Michelle? She should be with us. Man, that was labor.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Yes. Greetings and greetings, Miss Michelle. I wanted to ask you a few questions. My first question, and maybe most important question is, if white people leave America, is it possible that that would end white supremacy?
Y'all ask questions that are like, yes or no. I'm so not, I don't answer questions that way, but I don't know. I think, also it's like 10 o'clock in North Carolina. I mean, I'm in Virginia right now and my brain's tired, but, no, because I think the remnants of how America's been constructed are still going to be present. Like, we're going to have to deal with that even if no white folks are around. Like, if every white person left today, we'd still have to deal with what was left, right? The residual effects of what whiteness has done and how that's connected to what it means to be an American and how it's connected to the construct of race. So I don't think it would solve everything. I don't think it would, I don't know if it's the answer. And that's authentic and genuine.
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry to interrupt. I thought said that white people commit white supremacy and not black people. So then if white people are not here to commit white supremacy in person, then who will be here to do it?
I did say that. And I think that I'm curious about how folks of color will align. And if we will just replicate systems of oppression based on our own experience, or if we'll create systems of liberation. That's what I'm curious about. That's why I said I don't know. Maybe white supremacy won't be happening, but something else is going to happen. Like, we're used to systems of dominance. So, yeah.
So sorry. Two more questions, so I can be quick.
Just get in.
If white
the
people
most important
left.
One, get the most important one. Everybody got two.
Man.
I know.
Okay. Well, I had a question in regards to yoga. I've heard a lot about tactical yoga clothing, where you can put guns in the yoga outfits. There'll be like specialized pockets or however these yoga pants are and yoga outfits are formed. You can also like put them like women will have guns in on their torso. Have you heard of these tactical yoga pants and guns
No.
in the yoga clothes?
I've never heard of this, and it makes me really curious about what's going on, because there are all these principles of yoga, the philosophy that would suggest that we should not actually be arming ourselves when we're engaging in the practice, but the practice is everything. And there was just a question about, should we be armed? So I'm never going to wear those clothes or be armed in that way, but because it feels counter to the philosophy of the practice as I understand it. And my understanding is limited. But I haven't heard of any, I'm sitting here like, what? I've never heard of what you're describing. And I believe it's a thing. Like, I believe it's real.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. He was with us for the shooting, the carrot hot dogs, the yoga in Virginia. And when we were at the gun range, talk about overlap. The shooting instructor that we had at the gun range in Florida, he emphasized breathing and balance.
Mm-hmm.
I said, wow, have we heard that before? Breath and balance at the yoga retreat? Wow. Amazing. It is only 7 here, but it is 10 on the East Coast. I had like 3 quick questions that I can get through, but I know it's late. We can, let you get your rest and recharge your brain for another powerful Thursday. If you have time for the 3 quick ones, that's great. If not, it's no worries. You've been super generous with your time.
You can ask the 3 questions, yeah.
Awesome. Let's see. Are you familiar with the works of Neely Fuller Jr. and or Dr. Francis Cress Welsing? They're black authors. Mr. Fuller's book, The United Independent Compensatory Code, short title, and Dr. Welsing, her book, The ISIS Papers?
No. I'm thinking about the second person you named, maybe, but not very familiar, no.
Okay. They both, Dr. Welsing is deceased, but before she passed, she lived in D.C. Mr. Fuller lives in D.C. as well, so they're kind of close to your area.
Okay.
They have both written about racism extensively, and definitions. Their work has had a big impact on myself and many of the folks who've been on this program. They've been guests on this program many times. Let's see. Next, in the book, Skill in Action, you write on page 20, as I began my own journey into actively training folks about racism, my co-trainer and mentor, Tima Okun, you mentioned her previously, she's a white woman, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Told me that anti-racist work requires love. She told me that I would have to love white people to do this work and that I would have to love myself in a world that has taught me to do the opposite. I was confused when she offered this advice about love. I considered myself an awake, conscious, compassionate, and loving person. What she was saying was something much deeper. She was suggesting that it is impossible to separate love from anti-racism work. Love needs to be at the center of the work. It is an act of loving care to engage in social justice work. There's that word again for Thomas in New York. My question, what does a non-white person have to do or not do to practice loving white people?
So I think that that's what she was telling me, and I also think it's not People need to do what they need to do based on their history, their experience, their trauma, their where they have agency and resources and what they believe. So I really want to be clear about that. Like, people do what you need to do. And I think what she was offering me in that moment is actually some liberation from what was really sort of tearing me apart, which was my fixation with everything that white people were doing that was like horrific. Like, I had a journal, it's red with sparkles on it, that I would write every racist thing that happened. And eventually I stopped because I was like, well, racism is happening all the time. And it's killing me to write down everything because I'm going to write every minute of every day. And I think she was responding to that, this like how I was relating. She also was a friend, and we were in a relationship. And I don't want to say that non-white folks have to love white people. Actually, I don't want to say that. But when I put yoga with that, which I actually think is about compassion in part, for me, just for Michelle Cassandra, it is part of my practice to offer and extend grace and compassion. And I don't always do it, and it's not always possible, and it's not always appropriate for me to do it. It's not always available to me, right? I can't always draw on those resources. And if I'm going to believe in nonviolence, which is part of the yogic philosophy, if I'm going to strive to believe in that, and I'm going to believe in something bigger than me, and I'm going to pay attention to how my energy affects other people, and I'm going to think about greedlessness and non-stealing, right? Like, if I'm going to think about living into yoga, for me, it actually requires me to extend love, not all the time. And not to every white person, just for your listeners to be very clear about what I'm saying. It's not a prescribed thing. So I think anti-racism is similar to the practice of yoga. If I'm going to talk about dismantling a system of oppression and racism, and I'm going to center
Oh, are you with us, Michelle? Hope we didn't lose her again. Can you hear me, Michelle? We'll see if we lost her. I'll see if I can call her back. I had one more question that I wanted to get in. Let's see if we can get her back briefly. Hope it's been worthy of your Wednesday evening.
Guess it hung up on us again.
It did. You were finishing your response.
White people didn't want me to say that. White supremacy always makes the phone hang up. I think white people do navigate space freely in a way. And I think white supremacy causes harm to white people too. And I think Tima was just talking. I think that's what she was talking about. Like, at some point, if we're going to actually be in a relationship, which that was our model of training, and that's not everyone's model. I just want to be clear. Like, that's just our, that's how it's trained in dismantling racism, that we have to actually believe in collective action. together, and love needs to be part of that. That's what she was saying to me. So I think, you know, for non-white folks, you can love white people or not, and I understand why you wouldn't, right? And I don't love every white person. And if I think about the intersection of yoga and anti-racism, I do think about compassion and love, because I think about the principles of yoga. So that's a rambling answer to your question.
Much obliged. You are almost done again. Thank you for your patience. I did want to make sure I got this question in, or I just wanted to get your response to this. As I read your book and listened to one of your interviews as well, and one of the interviews that you did in 2018, you mentioned your adopted brother who has a white parent and a black parent. You were talking about how your household growing up was racial. You said that your father, black male, that he separated from your mom and remarried a white woman. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. That's accurate.
Okay. And you're saying that it was racial. The whole household, you know, was racial for you growing up, even though it wasn't talked about explicitly. Your brother's experience, dad, blah, 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 all this other stuff. So I heard that, and I know we've had a lot of conversations. Feverish black males, where that's been discussed on the program for years. Pam the Great. Woo. But I heard that and I started just looking at different anecdotes. One, I was thinking from the beginning, and I told listeners this, I'm suspicious anytime that white people are excited or praise a live black person, should I emphasize, black person who is talking about racism. It always gives me pause, like, what's going on here? Because I've seen where almost without exception, it'll be a non-white person who is not talking accurately about racism, which is fine. Like, I'm not always accurate myself. Like, we can all do that. But I generally feel that is a very sophisticated way that white people practice racism. They will elevate and praise non-white people who talk about racism in an inaccurate way. So we get to your book. I hear lots of white women at the yoga studio who I think are racist praise this book. And so I pause, like, what is going on here? Why would they praise and celebrate this book? I read the book, and one thing that did kind of stick out, or many things, several, loving white people, that would be one where I'd say, okay, I could see why racists would like that. Forgiving white people, I could see how racists would like that. Black misandry is something that I have paid attention to quite a bit over the last, I'd say, 2-3 years. One, because I have the term now. Words are important. That's what that is. Black misandry. Tommy Curry, we started the audio. The book's representation of black males at times is another point where I said I could see why racists would like this. The book starts, it says that your dad was absent. My father was primarily absent and only came when called by Child Protective Services. Even though I know that that's accurate frequently in the system of white supremacy, white people are to blame for that. But black males get a lot of flack for that. Deadbeat dads, no goods, even from President Obama. You mentioned Jeffrey Herrick, your husband, white male, at the beginning of the book. I just mentioned the anecdote where your dad remarried to a white woman. The collaborators, when I checked on the website, you have white women as the collaborators for your effort, and then some black females as well, but I didn't see any males, white or non-white. And then there was an anecdote mentioned on your book, page 63, and you were you were talking about a moment where you got stopped by enforcement officials in 2017. And you said this was just after, in fact, I can read it, during the summer of 2017, I was stopped by a police officer 2 weeks after the police had murdered two black men. And you go on to give the rest of the anecdote. And I stopped there. Dr. Curry even has talked about this. So many black males die. I'm not sure who these black males are, but where black death is kind of used to support a concept or whatever viewpoint is, the black males aren't even identified who died here. And I do want to make sure I point out Trayvon Martin, named in the book, Eric Garner, named in the book. But in this anecdote, the 2017 black males who died aren't even identified, where I think somehow that's how black males can be, I think the concept used in the book, invisibilized or kind of written out. And the death is just kind of used to support whatever argument or structure that we have. Those were some of the points I would put together where I could say, oh, this seems like where I could see some black misandry here. Some of the popular themes that I hear talked about with black males. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts about invisibilizing, or specifically thoughts about
these points that I put together, different points from the book and or things that have been shared when you've talked, your dad, child protective services, you being married to this white guy, your dad leaving your black mother to remarry a white woman. These seem to be points that would reinforce a not so glowing narrative of black males. In fact, these seem to be a lot of the points that get reinforced when people are kind of haranguing and scolding black males. I label this black misandry. Do you think that could be the case, that you see some of these patterns, or am I misreading, just kind of pulling things together that are not intended?
Not consciously, no. I think I was, you know, in all of the examples you gave, I was sharing my story, not necessarily thinking about reinforcing stereotypes about black men. And so, and yet, I understand that's maybe that's the impact, right? That certainly was not consciously, that wasn't my intention at all. I was just weaving in personal narrative. And I also, you know, I think the example of the being stopped by the police and me not naming the black men, which Alton Sterling and Philando Castile are the two men that I was naming. I just didn't name them in that part of the book. I think, there was something for me about, like, this happens all the time. Like, I do know who they are, and maybe I don't know because this happens all the time. And this is seen as the norm, and it's not normal to me. I do think with that specific example, I was feeling like, yeah, this is what happens every day. And again, I wasn't trying to reinforce these stereotypes at all. I think I was just trying to share part of my story. But it's hard to, I've been conditioned too, right, by culture and by my story and by my family and racialized experiences. So it's really hard to separate out the ways in which I've been conditioned and how that informs how I tell story. The culture has to inform that, which is why I said not consciously. So perhaps, and it wasn't my intention at all to do that.
Super appreciate the man. Yo, that is yoga right there. Just being truthful, because I have been conditioned. Anybody that has listened to the context of white supremacy, we've had the same sound clip to end every program for nearly 11 years. What does it say? My conditioning has been conditioned. There is a reason that has been there for 11 years, and it is not going
That's
to move
funny.
Until this system has been totally eradicated. Just
right.
The candor,
yeah.
And that is yoga. Just to be honest, I have been conditioned. Who honestly on this line is, oh no, I haven't been conditioned, and or I was conditioned, but I have totally eradicated, detoxified. I've moved on from that. I'm good. That's what I thought. We should have total silence on that one. I do want to point out, though, because I think the black misandry point, Philando Castile and Alton Sterling both were murdered in 2016. This is referenced in 2017.
Yeah.
So it's not, they're not identified, and the year is wrong. And that's, again, that goes to the point that Dr. Curry was mentioning, where they just become invisible. In fact, he says it in the book so eloquently. We know black male, exactly what you just said. We know black male style. Yeah, their name, whatever, it's Trayvon. Whichever one it was. They just, it's just a pile of black debt. That's the only way that we know black. That becomes the only way we know black males. Rapists, they got killed by the police. They married a white woman. Like, it's a very narrow field of how we end up seeing black misandry. I appreciate the candor for even thinking about it. We have been discussing Skill in Action with Michelle Cassandra Johnson, who has been extraordinarily generous with her time. It's 10:30 p.m. The website, again, is michellecjohnson.com. Many, many thanks for Man, again, I have been seeing her name since 2018 when I go to the yoga studio to practice. I have such a yoga brag now when they bring up her name. Oh, man, we interviewed her, man. Get out of here. Woo! Thank you so much for sharing some of your time with us. It has been amazing. Please visit the website. We would love to have you back on the program to continue the dialogue if you are willing. Oh no, did it just, that is ridiculous. They hung up and gone on us again. Dang, I feel like I should get her back on just to close out properly. Like, maybe I can call back just to close things out correctly. I super appreciate the candor for folks. I'll make sure to get a word in on that as we wrap up.
Just cut off.
It did. I was trying to give a proper,
you know.
You
were wrapping up.
Yes. Thank you for hanging out with us and being so generous with your time. And I was saying we would love to have you back. If we haven't plucked your nerves and taken up too much of your time, it would be great to continue the dialogue.
I'd love that.
And yoga and racism. Skill in Action. Yeah. Is the book. Please check her out if she comes to do a workshop or stops by, visit the website. She has lots of writings about yoga and racism. You can drop her an email about yoga, racism, both. It has been a pleasure to be able to chat with you. Keep up the outstanding work, Michelle. We will look forward to being in touch soon.
Thank you so much for inviting me to the show, and thanks for your listeners and the people who called in with questions. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Take care.
You too.
Context. Bye-bye. Yes, ma'am. Good evening. Context of White Supremacy, Michelle Cassandra Johnson. We had all those interruptions, too, where they were disrupting the phone line. Usual suspects. Michelle Cassandra Johnson. Was great to have her on the program. I can only say that again. I am not sure. Before the flood, I was not practicing racism. I am not sure if I would have bumped into her material, the book, because I just don't know. I'm just not sure how I would have become aware of it. I guess a listener could have mentioned it, but none of you all have at this point. I'm not sure that would have happened. Practicing yoga. That's another one. When I keep seeing things repeatedly like that, I told you I was seeing her poster every day. I used to practice in the part of the studio at the front where they had the poster. So I would see it every day. And then they go to a brand new studio where I would be hired. And they're talking about the same book, same person. Like, generally I pay attention to those sort of things. Might be cues about what you're supposed to be doing, signals from the creator maybe. Anywho, we'll be here in 24 hours. Environmental racism. Michelle talked about having asthma. She talked about breath. Environmental racism. I am very sure that has something to do with not being able to breathe correctly when the air has been toxified. Chemical, biological warfare. Same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I did want to say our caller in Virginia, she asked about the difference of vinyasa, yin. Michelle Cassandra Johnson is 500-hour certified, where I would like to be one day. But caller in Virginia, you were with us for the retreat in VA. The more active yoga sessions that we did in the morning, that's vinyasa. That's what she talked about with the breath to movement, deliberate placement, going to be more of a flowy type of experience. That was the vinyasa that we were doing. If you can remember what we did a year ago, I know. But if you can remember the things that we did in the morning, that's vinyasa. And then in the evening, we do the more calm, even though we did a more like restorative yin. You can have yin classes that are a little more energetic, where you might break a little bit of a sweat with some of the postures, but generally they're going to be exactly what she said, more on the ground. You'll be holding the postures longer. If you get a restorative yin class, I love those. They might, you know, do no lights, because you're not going to be standing or jumping around or anything. You'll just be on the ground holding the postures. You might even fall asleep. Like, love restorative yin, where she talked about having props, bolsters, and all that goodness. Anyway, I will only say, I'll go to folks who called in. Thank you. I would have allowed folks to get in more questions, but there were so many callers. Like, I looked at the thing for the switchboard to see the number of hands, and every time I thought we were making progress, it would just be more hands. So there was a reason. I was just trying to see if I could get through as many. And then I knew I had questions that I wanted to ask. So I will only say, it is important, I think, to trust your instincts. I often feel I don't have anything popular to say, meaning I don't have a great speech where I can come out and make an announcement where people will cheer or be even happy to see me. Like, that is just not the case. Like, if you're just going to come out and talk about racism, they're going to throw tomatoes and rotten fruit at you. I feel like that's kind of what it is. You just accept that. That's part of the, I mean, look at Dr. King, you know, it might be worse than tomatoes. It might be bullets and that sort of thing. So I was reading, preparing for the program with Michelle Cassandra Johnson. I'd already told you all I have suspicions when white people really are excited about a black person who talks about racism if they're still alive. So said, okay, let's see what, you know, the book has in store. And as soon, because the comment about her dad, which she said is true, but her dad not being there except for child support enforcement, they had to kind of make him be present. That's at the very beginning of the book. That, and then her shout out to Jeffrey, who is her former white husband. That right there, I didn't know she was involved with a white person before, but that's huge. That sends such a signal off. In fact, I submit whites are not ignorant. Just that alone. That's how a non-white person starts. I already see, okay, black self-respect is not high, not going to be that high. And then we keep reading, love white people, boom, 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 married to a white, okay, oh yeah, oh yeah. This is, can already see, this is not going to be an indictment of white people, even though she did say she is tough, but I can already see where racists would be like, oh yeah, this is acceptable. Huge, same thing, I mentioned this with Azur Savage. He was on the program beginning of December, where I said, Azur has a white parent. Azur identifies as transgender. All of these things, racists would see that and say, oh yes. And same thing, Azur book, she was at Elliott Bay, he was at Elliott Bay Books. Lots of people, they said it was one of the more popular, more well attended events. There is a reason for that. Racist white supremacists, they are very discerning about their victims and how we have been conditioned. But I thought that was so huge. I didn't have all the, just even as continuing to go to collect, I thought that was important too. When we got to the end, I was a little hesitant. I wasn't going to say anything about that, but I thought that was important. If it was a white person, the incident I'm talking about where she said she was stopped by the police and it was two black males that were killed. If it had been a white woman, we identify that white woman. That, oh my goodness, this happened. She died and it was a terrible thing and the impact. Black males, black people, period. But that black misandry, they're like, they don't even get... So many black males die. And I so appreciate that she did not get an attitude. She did not call me a coon. I've been conditioned. I don't think I did that consciously, but I can see that. I so appreciate that because I feel like a lot of black people would not be patient about that. Like, what are you saying? Are you saying I hate black males? Which I didn't say. I'm just saying I'm looking at the examples that are here and I see some common tropes in terms of how black males are presented. Feverish, all of us, yes. Pam the Great. If folks have any thoughts that they would like to share, proceed. If you missed a question that you thought was important, feel free. Anybody, if you think Gus was talking crazy about the black misandry point, please make sure that you speak up loud, because I said I was a little hesitant, but then after I had, when I had three things written down, it was, it seems like it could be a pattern. After I had about four things, it's like, yeah, I need to say something about this. Black misandry. Thank you, Dr. Curry. The man not race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood. Folks who dialed in, did you have a commentary?
Got it heard?
Let's see. Heard both of you.
You first, Firefighter.
Oh, okay, he's yielding. Proceed, Firefighter.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I think today's report was interview was a good lesson on good exercise in VGQ. There were some points that I kind of thought was not logical when she was stating her assumption of white people being ignorant. The two words, logically speaking, in my mind, do not go together under the global system. of racism, white supremacy, and it is highly, highly dangerous to have that understanding. I was quite happy that you suggested the potential of studying Dr. Frances Cress Welsing and Mr. Fuller, and hopefully she is able to grasp that information and develop an understanding of it. Last but not least, she never did state on, she used, I think, the term neutralizing or something similar to the term neutralizing the system of racist white supremacy, but I didn't hear exactly on what her idea in mind and understanding was to replace it with. I did hear the word, which I do not use at all, I heard the word liberation at least two or three times. And that would have been another question that I would have asked her. When she says liberation, what does she mean? And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
I do think she used that term quite a few times, liberation, some variant. Much obliged, retired firefighter. Mr. Blue, did you have commentary, sir?
Yes, sir. Greetings, all. First of all, I've seen her video on the Black Talk Radio Network site, so I looked at the video prior to the interview tonight, because I haven't got the book. I don't have the book, but I did want to see and read the comments that she had under the video and hear what she had to say. And many a times, she used words liberation, social justice. She used the word privilege a lot. And so I was like, well, let me hear how she's going to present herself, the things that she's going to say. I kind of know some of the questions that Gus is going to ask and the type of questioning and the type of conversation that you all will have. Because, once again, she is a victim. Like us all, she's confused. I'm always learning. She's still learning. Hopefully she learned something tonight. But at the beginning, when one, she revealed that she had a husband and for how long that she was married to this white male, I was like, okay. Then it seemed that all of the teachers that were teaching her about dismantling racism, teaching her about yoga, teaching her how to do these social justice yoga racial classes, all of them seemed to be either white males or white females. And I was like, okay. Once again, when white people enjoy something that a non-white, particularly black person who is living, is doing or producing, I have to be suspect of. And it was just very eye-opening, very interesting. And Gus, I've listened to January 11th. I think the firearm that the grandmother had talked about was the Sig Sauer P365. It's a subcompact that is used for carry and conceal. One of the most well-known, as I've been researching, by white women and white males, but particularly white women, one of the most well-known and most used and sought after and bought by people who classify themselves as white and white women, subcompact conceal and carry weapons. So I think that's the one she was talking about when she was having that conversation with us. And after that, I'll mute my line. Good night and greetings to all.
Much obliged, Mr. Blue, with us at the retreat. She was downright giddy about the Sig Sauer. Absolutely. The concealed carry version that she had. I'm looking at the 365 now. We didn't shoot with that one, but yeah. Yeah, the concealed carry version of that one. I'm sure you could do quite the white woman, racist man, racist woman, racist child. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with us again, anybody, if Gus did not, if you sound like I'm just making up stuff about the black misandry, please speak up. Make sure we're not giving out inaccurate or illogical reports or views on the problem. Other folks, any other thoughts they wanted to share?
Yeah, Gus. I just wanted to ask a question. I sent the tweet, so I sent the video of I want to know if you got it. I sent the video of what was happening with the iTunes. Anytime I clicked on a video, I want to know, did you get it? Did you see a tweet like that?
I have not checked my tweet feed. However, we did. I had one of the folks at the retreat, and then we had a listener on the compensatory call-in who also said that the iTunes feed was not working correctly, that it would play like 5 minutes or so and then not update or not play the rest of the audio clip. So I am aware that there is some problem with the iTunes feed. I know what I told the caller on Saturday, the iTunes feed has been not with, just like with the phone line what we had tonight where we kept having to call Michelle back. The iTunes feed has been just as uncooperative for the past 11 years, and that is beyond my control, other than, you know, I upload the content. But in terms of it playing or not playing the full content, that is beyond my control. I have emailed the whites in charge at iTunes numerous times over our tenure. Sometimes they respond, sometimes they don't. The main point of emphasis that I have here is that hopefully the iTunes feed will somehow work again. That's generally what happens. It will not work for a while and then it'll start working again. Hopefully that will happen, but in the meantime, the content is uploaded at Black Talk Radio Network, SoundCloud, YouTube, Google Play, and other outlets. That's just four that I can think of, like right off the top. It is current. You can download, you can stream at all of those sites. I'll make sure to go out and tweet the address so that people can see the links for all those other sites as well, just to make sure that you don't have to feel dependent. If iTunes is a matter of convenience, like that's the easiest site, I totally get it. Racists do a phenomenal job at trying to take away convenience and accessing constructive material for non-white people. So I will do my best to make sure it's easily accessible. SoundCloud, YouTube, Black Talk Radio Network, Google Play, and hopefully iTunes will be cooperating again soon. So I did not see your specific tweet, but I am very aware that iTunes is not working.
Okay. Okay, then just one last thing. When I asked the question about was her extended family, was her husband's, ex-husband's family supportive, she was kind of vague. She really didn't go into detail of how they was supportive. So, you know, I didn't really want to, be accusatory and say that, that maybe they were, indifferent about her work, which was the conclusion I got from her response. So I would have liked her to go into further detail of how supportive, her husband's family was.
That would have been. Wish we'd had more time. That would have been nice. It seemed, you all can let me know. Maybe I'm, you know, hallucinating. When I asked, because the guy's name is Jeffrey, her former husband's name is Jeffrey Herrick, Jeffrey Herrick, Herrick. Now, I had looked to see his image online as I was reading the book, and he looked like someone that was classified as white. I didn't know, you know, what the arrangement was. She used the term partner. Now, I know in certain parlance that, you know, that term is used that, you know, this is my boyfriend or whatever it is. You have the whole LGBTQ thing, so I get it. I don't know. Like, ex-former husband seems like substantial. That it just seemed like if you paid close attention there, it almost seemed like that was not something that she wanted to spend to talk about in depth, which I can grasp. We've heard a lot of examples from that. Yeah, probably not something that she would be expecting right at the beginning of the program to be having a question that's leading to her ex-white husband. But yeah, it did seem like there was some discomfort in talking about that at all, I guess, you know, unless folks are thinking I'm making that up. I will say also, man, the acknowledgments, that is something I have not always done. When you read a book and they make an acknowledgement or shout outs at the begin, particularly at the beginning of the book. You should probably pay attention if you get a chance to read the book. If the author comes on the program, you should probably ask. You never know what details you might get from that. But wow, and matter of fact, now let me go back and reread this. Now that we know Mr. Herrick is a former husband. So the acknowledgement, it says, first, I want to acknowledge Jeffrey Herrick. He has been my biggest cheerleader. He has supported me in so many ways, and this book is no exception. He said yes when I asked him to go to Kenya with me for the first time to volunteer with the Africa Yoga Project. That project birthed my decision to lead a teacher training on social justice and yoga. The inception of that teacher training led one of my trainees to suggest that I write a book about the process of merging social justice and yoga. There is that term again, social justice. But yeah, I will say just that right there. I think white people, that's huge. You start a book about racism and white supremacy, and the first person mentioned is your ex-white husband shouting you out and talking about you all's trip to the continent. That is a wrap. I totally see how racist we got. And then all you have to do is flip 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pages. So that was the very first page for the acknowledgments, and then we're in the opening, and it's, for the first days of my life, I lived in an incubator hooked up to tubes and monitored by doctors and nurses when I should have been connecting with my mama. My father was primarily absent and only came when called by Child Protective Services. That's a wrap. In my view, racists are not ignorant. They are going to get all of that much quicker than Gus T. Married to a white man. You all went to the continent together, black male, probably some dad issues in the system of white supremacy. We create that, whites. We create that. We create absent fathers. That's what we do. That's all by design. We got practice making absent fathers in a lot of different ways. But Child Protective Services, like, oh, yeah, bang, sign that one up. We got it. Already got it. That's what I'm contending, that they can do the math on that very fast. They, what does the sound clip say? What did I tell her before she exited? Our conditioning has been conditioned. They know their Negroes very well. And I'm saying all you would have to do is read the first 6 pages. Got it. That's why white people would be very happy with a book like this, unless I'm in error. Other folks have comments they want to make sure they get in.
Can I be heard? You can go.
Imhon DC is yielding. Henry in Chicago, proceed.
Okay. I guess in response to what you were mentioning about the Black Misandry piece that you saw in her book, I didn't read the book, but I typically don't see it as, well, from what you have said and what you have read in the book, I don't typically see it as Black Misandry. I mean, just the way I define Black Misandry is just kind of like a deep-seated conscious hate for black men. Or black males. And I think more of her, you know, not mentioning the victims of the violent attacks of police and, you know, her black father leaving, you know, their family for a white, you know, for a white woman. You know, I think that's more, I guess that's more, you know, anti-black male, which I can see as kind of like an unconscious thing. So, yes, and I think she explained it, too, where we kind of internalize, you know, our own racism because of the fact that, you know, we in the system of white supremacy have been taught to hate ourselves, and especially black males. But I don't think she had, like, you know, this deep-seated contempt for black men, even though she did explain that, you know, most of the black men in her life, you know, have not, and probably because of the system of white supremacy, have not been, that image of what, you know, we should see as, you know, as a positive black male. And so, you know, I kind of take a different turn on that. I don't think it was, for me personally, maybe VGQ, but, you know, I don't see that as Black Misandry, what you said. But that's all I have on my mind.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Imhon DC.
Yes, sir. I was going to say quickly about the guns inside of your yoga pants. A lot of, what I see online, the women will have single stack compact guns. So they're smaller or they're thinner. It's easier to conceal. And the Glock option is the 43. And I wanted to say, don't get any holster that is not full Kydex. And I don't advise somebody put guns in their yoga pants. I don't think that makes sense. But I was going to say for the guest, I was going to ask her. One thing I wanted to ask her is, can there be white supremacy without white people? After listening to all this and reviewing everything, can there be white supremacy without white people? Just something to think about.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. Any other folks with us have comment they want to get in before we wrap up? Almost done.
Can I be heard? Yes,
let's see. Please, we'll get right on. Caller in Virginia.
Okay. I thought your question to her about what her top three books were was a very telling and exposing question. As a trainer in anti-racism, for her to not be able to cite her source material for her training, I think was an error on her part. She mentioned, you know, The Bluest Eye that she read in middle school as being one of her top three. So I thought that was very curious. So I would have questioned her a little bit more about, okay, well, you're doing these training. Who are you getting your information from? You know, if you haven't heard of Neely Fuller, you haven't heard of Francis Cress Wilson, you haven't heard of anybody else, really. So I was very curious about that. And I would ask her that if we had another opportunity to talk. But thank you so much for the program. I thought you handled it very well. I agree with your points. And I think she was very uncomfortable, but this is the work she's chosen. And it would seem also that, you know, she's chosen to do this work among white people mostly. So, you know, I don't know if I feel sympathy toward any frustration that she might feel, because I think she's trying very hard with white people, even though clearly I don't think she believes they're redeemable. So I'm not sure why she's focusing so much on them. But VGQ, as we've all stated. Thank you.
VGQ, that has been invoked many times. Love it. Victims Guaranteed qualify for people. If you are a first-time listener, newer listener, Victims Guaranteed qualified. VGQ. Mail caller spoke up simultaneously.
Yes, sir.
You can speak up a little bit. Your volume is kind of low. You can speak up, sir, please.
Gotcha. I enjoyed the dialogue. I thought it was definitely a good show. I wanted to ask her one question in regards to the historic references of yoga, how far back it goes, and I've heard from other yoga practitioners here that are black that it goes back into African, you know, traditions. But I didn't really get a chance to ask her that. I wanted to know what kind of books that she would suggest to look into some of the history of yoga to find out a little bit more in depth. But overall, it was a very good show. I appreciate that time that she took in answering everybody's questions. It was a lot.
Yes, it was. My finger was tired just going up and down the switchboard. Every time I thought we made progress, it was just more hands and more hands. She was very generous with her time and her answers, responses. Bluest Eye was mentioned again. We did read that book on the cows, so it's not like I'm unfamiliar with that text, and that book is in my top five. However, I think I just said, man, you cannot get away from that black misandry, where even in that book, black male rapist is kind of at the center, I think. Anybody else? Comment they wanted to get in?
Maybe
Ivy, yes, ma'am.
I really enjoyed her. I hope she comes back on. I thought that she, in a lot of ways, displayed a lot of understanding, and even the article that she wrote about being stopped by the cops. I don't know if it was in September of some year. I don't know if it was the same one that was in the book or if it was some other one, but it was the article that you posted on your Facebook page, and I thought that she was very open to learning, because even when I spoke about, you know, if we're to blame, she pretty much, I would say, changed her answer. She went from we're implicated in racism to we're implicated in just some other things. Jane Elliott has been a guest in the program, I believe it was 5 times. You mentioned that earlier that you forgot how many. I think it was like 5 times. I will say this. I think it was absolutely, I would even say it was Blackness Andrew, and it was conscious and it was deliberate in terms of what she said about her father, because you can't unconsciously make a statement like that. Like, that was an insult. That was what people would call a shot. It was cruel, and it was flippant, and it was just a real, I'm not saying this to insult her in any way, but I would say that it was a real tacky way of making that point, to say that, oh, he only came around when it was child support or whatever it was. And I wonder if white people, if that was a result of their interference, because I think you mentioned that she said that in the book that they have some influence on that. So whether it be the way that they have brain trashed her, whether they wrote it themselves, that part, or whatever the case may have been. And, you know, non-white people are confused in general. And so with her, she has been confused by white people up close and personal, with her husband, with her former husband, with, I believe she had a white step-parent, Gus?
Her dad remarried a white woman, so unless I'm misinformed, that would be called a white stepmother.
Yeah, so, you know, so she had, you know, the confusion up close and personal. Most of us have not, and we still are confused. So, you know, I can understand her situation. Also, in my view, she did not answer your question about what it means to love white people. She just kind of went into this, I guess, explanation, pretty much justifying, or not justifying, but just explaining why she said that, and emphasizing that she's not projecting that on anyone else, and she's not prescribing that for anyone else. But I don't think she answered your question directly at all. Of what that actually means to love whites, what you have to do or not do to be loving them. Also, there are over 6 million more white children in single-parent homes than black children, and over 70% of children in single-parent homes are white. So this thing about absentee fathers, that award goes to white people, as usual. And in terms of the justification of her Blackness Andrew being that some black people in her life were a bad example, ain't nobody been a worse example of just humanity and trash than white people. And she had a whole lot and has a whole lot of those people in her life. Her ex-husband is an example, because they, first of all, she's not even married to that person no more. And I would doubt very seriously that it would be all her fault. So I would imagine that he had a lot of mistreatment and terrorism that he committed against her that led to that divorce. And the last two things I want to say is that I believe she asked, you know, why would, and she, I believe she asked this rhetorically, why would white people give up their power? And you hear this a lot. And things like along the lines of, you know, white people be crazy to give up their power. But the interesting thing about that is we're not willing to apply that same standard to rapists, to child rapists, to drug dealers, and things of that nature. It's like, what is it that white people have to do to non-white people for it to be logical for them to give up their power? The reason that they will give it up is because of how they got it. So, and I would say that. And the last thing I want to say real quickly is that I wanted to ask her if cultural appropriation is the most accurate term to use for cultural theft, because that's what white people do. And I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus.
Asteya, that's one of the yoga principles. Non-theft, not supposed to be stealing. Whites steal whole people. Anybody else comment they need to get in? Mom in Michigan, anybody else question, comment? Got to be concise. Grant. Folks are satisfied. Really quick, Ivy, you said, well, could it not just be true, the statement about her dad not being there except for child protective services? If that's true, which, you know, she said it was, why couldn't it just be that this was true? That I'm not trying to be cruel or make any sort of personal insults, that, you know, it was, this is a statement of fact. I was born premature. I was in an incubator. My dad was absent until child protective services. Why can't that just be a statement of fact?
There are a lot of facts about white people, and she don't talk about them like that. She don't have the same tone for them. So there was a different way to say that. There was a more compassionate, understanding, and less flippant way to say that. She could have just said, you know, that he wasn't around as much or whatever. I don't even know really what was the point of even saying that, but if she wanted to say that, she could say that. But it's just kind of like if I was to say, you know, white people don't never come around unless they want to pillage. There's another way that I could say that. I could say, you know, white people practice racism, or, you know, white people, they do incorrect things, or whatever these, for lack of words, gentle ways we talk about white people. So I'm saying that where the black misandry comes in, there's a way that you could talk about white people that shows your contempt for them. And there was a way to me that she talked about that incident or that situation with him not being around that shows his contempt, her contempt rather, for him. Does that answer your question?
Yes, ma'am. That does. Much obliged. If folks are satisfied, or I guess I'll give you two. These will be our two to conclude. What a long day. Woof. Sweet potato pie, snow, program, teaching yoga in the morning. I will bring you a slice of sweet potato pie if you want to come practice yoga at 6 a.m. in the morning. That'll be the reward for braving the ice and cold weather here in Seattle. If you're in the area and you want to do 6 a.m. yoga, slice of sweet potato pie, vegan. But the two things, it's not in the book, but it's in, I'll have to tweet it or I'll post it on Facebook and all. It's an interview Michelle Cassandra Johnson did in 2018, and she mentions briefly her situation with her brother, adopted brother, white parent, black parent, and her dad who remarried a white woman, and just the tone. I could be wrong, but just the tone. It off. Pamela Evans Harris, feverish. It almost sounded like we were going to get a feverish reference for her dad. And I might be wrong. Like I said, I'm just, you know, I'm listening to tone, although this is something that we've been, you know, I and others have been listening to, researching for quite some time, not just a couple days or weeks anyway. So I heard that and I thought, wow, wait a minute, man, if you married a white man, why would there be any feelings about? Anyway, you can go, I'll post it. You can listen. You can let me know, Gus, you are talking crazy again. There was nothing. That was just you making things up, and it wasn't even that long. The little snippet that she mentioned, you know, her dad marrying this white woman. No feverish tones at all. I'll post it. You can come to your own conclusions. The black misandry is extraordinarily minimized. My God, that is one of the hugest lessons that I have learned in the system of white supremacy. Thank you, Dr. Curry. Language to put on that. Black misandry. The man, not race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood. We'll be here tomorrow. Harriet A. Washington, medical. Oh, same medical apartheid. We already read that. A Terrible Thing to Waste. That's what we're reading now. A Terrible Thing to Waste. We're only on the second chapter, so you are not behind. Ready to roll. I'm super excited. Last week was all about how white people insist that we are ignorant, and then they'll turn around and say that we're the experts on racism. Anyway, she's working in now to the toxifying chemical and biological warfare and how that disrupts our brain computers. Tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. More yoga. Got to get that again. How could I not mention as we conclude counter-racist yoga retreat? If you want to be in an environment where you can do yoga and not be around whites, all victims of white supremacy, eat great food, plant-based meals, maybe sweet potato pie. Springtime, we might do cobbler of some sorts, but lots of vegan deliciousness. Maybe go to the gun range. Canada is gun town too, so we can do some shooting. May 21 to May 24. Drop an email. UntilJustice@gmail.com. There were quite a few callers tonight. There were so many I couldn't nab everybody, but retired firefighter, Blue, Imhan DC, caller in Virginia. It was a lot of folks who have made it. Young academic was out there listening in, spectating, but there were quite a few folks who've been to the retreats who called in to participate, exchange views, have these conversations live in person over some vegan sweet potato pie and yummy tea, do some yoga together, do some breathing exercises together. May 21 to May 24, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, the COWS 2020 Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat. Deadline to register is February 29. Non-refundable deposit of $400. All the information is on my blog. Again, you can drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, if you would like more details. The final portion of payment, $260, is due May 1. Deadline, February 29, $400 deposit, non-refundable. Final $260 is due May 1. Again, we have details, discounts for children, and all of that. Drop an email if you need more info. Get your passport. Get your passport. We will see you in Toronto. With that, man, much obliged. Hope it was worthy of everyone's time and energy. Thanks for the callers. Robust participation, hopefully, or wish we could have got more of your questions in. Great questions. Everyone was super patient. VGQ, everyone was super patient. I was thankful nobody, not that I expected it, but nobody was discourteous. She is a victim of racism, who was super patient, and I appreciated her hanging out, sharing some time on the broadcast. We'll be here tomorrow. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Protect your brain computer. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, driver or passenger. Let's do everything we can to be as safe as possible under conditions of terrorism. If you're driving, you are sober, you are buckled up, and you are never on the cell phone. Again, just trying to do what we can to minimize contact with the Amber Geigers, Daniel Holtzclaws of the known universe. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. COWS signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.